Get out your notebook. There's more.
Two Wars. Well, this is Joe Lauria for CN Live. Welcome to CN Live. I'm Joe Lauria, the Editor-in-Chief of Consortium News.
And I'm Elizabeth Voss.
Two wars dragging humanity into despair and existential peril have in the past week sunk to levels difficult to comprehend. The danger of a nuclear confrontation between Russia and the West over Ukraine has been theoretically with us for nearly 3 years. But last week, it took on terrifyingly concrete form. And in the metastasizing wars in the Middle East, which carry their own more distant atomic threat, the genocidal rage of an unbalanced Israel spread deeper into Lebanon, while all-out war with Iran simmers. The ethnic cleansing of at least the north of Gaza is no longer denied in the Israeli press, and much of the world's patience with the Zionist state ran out as its prime minister was indicted by an international criminal court never intended to pursue Western and allied leaders. On the program today to help us understand all of this is former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, ex-UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, and Ted Postal, professor emeritus of science, technology, and international security at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I'm Joe Lauria, and I'm joined by Elizabeth Voss. Last week, the U.S. and the U.K. used Ukrainian territory to fire their own long-range missiles into Russia, despite Russia's stern warnings that it meant war with them. Russia responded with a new intermediate-range hypersonic missile that can reach all of Europe and cannot be shot down. Ray McGovern, thanks for coming back on CN Live after such a long time. I want to start with you. When was the last time you experienced such a week in world events?
It's hard to remember, Joe. There have been some, but this one particularly disturbing. The main news, of course, is that not only can the Russians strike at will with these new missiles, but they're so confident of their accuracy that they promise to warn people, get your civilians out of the way. We'll give you enough time to get your civilians out of the way, and we're not worried about the time we give you to prepare because you ain't going to be able to knock down any of these missiles. This goes back quite some ways. It's not something that Putin devised explicitly with respect to Ukraine. We have him on record talking to Western journalists in June of 2016 saying, don't you guys understand? Don't you understand that we see through what your plans are? Those missile bases in Romania and the one you're building in Poland, we know that you could use those same capsules for cruise missiles or for ballistic missiles. We know that. So why are you playing this game? We're not going to play the game. We're going to develop our own capabilities to counter all these things. And then, wonder of wonders, the president of Russia, Putin, on the 1st of March 2018, so about 2 years later, said, okay, now I'm going to show you what we have. Now, I'm not going to tell you all the details about how accurate these are or how, you know, but here's, and he did a show and tell, for God's sake. He had he had movies up there, big screens, and he showed how these newly developed weapons would work, some of them. Then he said, I'm not going to tell you about all of them. And of course, now he has told us about one key one developed relatively recently to deal specifically with the situation in Ukraine, where the U.S., the French, and the British, and God knows what the Germans will do, have decided to provoke Russia before Russia finally wins in Ukraine. I wish I could figure out what the hell they have in mind, because even they admit, that is, speaking through their little newspapers, the Washington Post, the New York Times, even though they admit that this will not change the trajectory of the battle, that Ukraine is not going to win this thing. So why are they doing this? Well, I hope we'll be able to discuss this because I'm not really clear on that.
Well, Ray, something fundamental changed in the White House because we were down this road twice before. In March 2022, Anthony Blinken went on his own, stepped out of line, to tell CBS News that the U.S. would give the green light to Poland to send MiG-29s into Ukraine to enforce a no-fly zone. And then that he was backed by Pelosi, by Schumer, by the rabid war-loving press. And then the Pentagon stepped in. Austin got to Biden, and Biden said, wait a minute, hold on. And he actually said these words. We're not – get this right, guys, talking to the press. We're not fighting World War III in Ukraine. And a no-fly zone would mean World War III with Russia. So that was the end of that. Blinken keeps his job. Then in last September this year, the British were led to believe by Blinken that they were going to get permission to use their Storm Shadow missiles, which needs U.S. technology. And Stormer flew here to Washington, to the White House. And then, again, Austin was able to get Biden to say no, and he pulled back. Apparently Jake Sullivan was on the side of the real this year and stopped. So that red line was not crossed. There's been an election. Biden lost. Trump's about to come in. What, in your view, Ray, led now Biden to say, let's do it? And most interestingly, we've heard nothing from the Pentagon this time. They have refused to comment at all. We don't even know whether how much they knew about what was coming on. And I think you may know something about that, too. Can, in fact, the White House order operational orders to the military without the Pentagon even knowing? What do you know about this, Ray, and what do you think changed here?
This is extraordinary. One wonders whether Secretary Austin or the Joint Chiefs were informed before this permission attributed to President Biden was given to ATACMS in Ukraine, and the British for Storm Shadow was given. It looks like he wasn't. I mean, you know about that press conference. Maybe there are two press conferences where the Pentagon spokeswoman would say, well, no, I can't tell you whether we were informed or not. I'm not going to answer that question. We just stand on what you see in the newspapers over the weekend. My God, all right? So is it possible? Is it possible that Blinken, speaking in the name of the president and Sullivan as the key person here, Sullivan in the White House, gave orders to the commander-in-chief in Usurer, whether they call it now, the commander, U.S. commander there, forces in Europe, and just sort of said, well, okay, this is the new rules, or whether Austin was involved and said, oh, well, we are, what can happen? As far as why, well, they want to make it difficult for Trump, to be sure. But sometimes when you have an overage president and a guy who's had megalomania forever, maybe Blinken went to Biden and said, look, it's not going to go good here. They were both in South America, for God's sake. Let's give permission to strike deeper into Russian territory. That way, Zelensky might stop complaining about, you know, we promised to be there forever and give him everything he needs for as long as he needs it. Well, that way, at least we can go out into the Western sunset, not having anyone dispute that we did everything we could for Ukraine, and look what's happened now. The Russians are winning, and Trump is going to give in. That's the only thing I can come to sensibly, other than, you know, trying to make it really difficult for Trump, which of course it will.
Well, Biden, to be fair, Biden did say that the purpose of these strikes were to hit what they think are North Korean troops in Kursk, inside Russian territory. They're legally, if the Russians invited them into Russia, pre-2014 Russia, and that the reason to do that was to prevent Russia from expelling Ukrainian troops from Kursk so they can have that territory to trade in upcoming negotiations. Obviously, Biden realizes that Trump's going to probably try to do some negotiations. So that is the stated purpose. But let me bring in Scott Ritter, former military man, Marine. Scott, a couple of questions here. First of all, Biden, in his comments 2 years ago saying that will cause World War III, knows that Russia is not bluffing necessarily. Anyway, could not take that chance. And yet something changed here. What, in your view, changed? And the military questions, can the White House bypass the Pentagon and order military action?
Well, the White House is the commander-in-chief, so the White House can pass, do anything it wants. The president is the commander-in-chief. He's the ultimate authority. When he issues an order, it is the order. Normally, you go through your chain of command, so if you want to communicate to American military units, you don't jump echelon. You will go to the Secretary of Defense, who will then pass the orders on down, et cetera. Understand right here, though, we're not talking about a U.S. military chain of command. We're already providing targeting data support. There's existing mechanisms in place. ATACMS missiles have been used against Russian targets in Crimea, Kherson, Zaporizhia, and the Donbass. So you don't have to reinvent this wheel. It's there. We have a military unit that is responsive already to a system where the Ukrainians designate a target and then they build the target package based on that, etc. All that was missing was the political decision to greenlight this. And so to give the political decision, you don't have to have the Secretary of Defense. It's a decision that can be communicated directly from the White House or through the State Department using existing channels. So it's unusual. Lloyd Austin was the lead on these issues, but he has historically voiced his opposition to allowing this. He said it will not change the outcome of the war, and it will lead us down a path of escalation that we don't want with the Russians. Biden has disregarded this. What has changed? What has changed is panic on the part of Europe. And, Biden had said that NATO, we have a sacred obligation to NATO to back it up, that it defines who we are and what we are as a nation, this alliance with Europe. And NATO's in a lot of trouble on a number of fronts. One, if Trump shuts off the spigot of aid to Ukraine, Ukraine loses the war in rapid order. And the collapse of Ukraine, the defeat of Ukraine, would be hugely embarrassing for NATO, an embarrassment that they can't survive. People tend to forget that in August of 2021, NATO was humiliated with the precipitous withdrawal from Afghanistan at the behest of the United States after spending nearly two decades in Afghanistan, promoting regime change, promoting nation building. They left with their tail between the legs. This was horrifically not only embarrassing, but it was divisive. It caused a lot of fractures to occur in NATO regarding unity of purpose, etc. So Ukraine was seen as the mechanism to fix this, that Ukraine would be the unifying policy around which NATO would redefine itself in terms of its purpose and the scope and scale of its operations. NATO cannot afford to lose in Ukraine, and yet they are losing in Ukraine. And now comes the point where they have to decide what to do about this defeat. And there are many who have said, well, we can't lose, so we must win. And in order to win, you have to, of course, change the strategy that you've been taking. Right now, NATO had imposed a series of red lines on what it could or couldn't do vis-a-vis Russia via Ukraine using the Ukrainian proxy. But what we've seen is over the two-plus years that this war has been going on, NATO self-imposed constraints. Then those constraints were lifted, and the concerns that Russia would overreact never manifested itself as they sent in F-16 fighters, as they sent in HIMARS, as they sent in ATACMS, etc. Russia just kept winning. I mean, the Russian response was, we're just going to keep winning. But to be honest, there's nothing about the ATACMS or the Storm Shadow when used against targets in Russia that will change the outcome of this war. It's not meaningful. It's not a game changer. But from a political perspective, it's everything, because the way these systems are targeted, the intelligence data that's used, it can't be done without the United States directing this, making this happen. So from the Russian perspective, when an ATACMS missile is used to strike territory in Russia, it is the United States attacking Russia. When the Storm Shadow is used, it's the British attacking Russia. And this means that Russia has to respond. And the question for Russia is, how do we respond without, you know, their goal is not to change the trajectory of things that are going on right now on the front line. They're winning. There's no one in the world right now that can say they're not winning. I mean, you know, Biden can make things up about North Koreans, and I'm just telling you right now, that's 100% fabrication. Ray can back me up on this one, not from the factual side, because nobody has seen any proof, but Ray knows how Russia operates. You are not going to get North Korean troops operating inside Russia without a treaty. That just isn't going to happen. They're just simply not going to jump on a train, cross the border, come on down, and just have a good old time and curse, killing Ukrainians. There has to be a treaty. That treaty has to be linked to mechanisms of preparation, et cetera, none of which can happen until the treaty is complete. That treaty was just ratified a few days ago. These rumors of North Koreans have been operating in Kursk now for over a month. It's made up. It's nonsense. It isn't happening. It hasn't happened. It won't happen. Russia doesn't need North Koreans. From a military standpoint, bringing 10,000 North Koreans into a fight where you say you need 50,000 Russians is absurd, because those 10,000 cannot contribute in a meaningful way to the battle because they don't know how to fight with the Russians. They haven't trained with the Russians. They don't know what Russian command and control is. They don't speak Russian. None of this. It would be actually a dramatic loss of combat capability if Russia were to absorb 10,000 North Korean soldiers. So this is stupidity in the extreme, and yet the Biden administration uses this as an excuse to launch ATACMS missiles, knowing that the Russians would interpret this as an American attack against Russia. What's happened here is, because NATO is so desperate to survive politically, and they fear what happens when Trump comes in, they're seeking to Trump-proof this. But the other thing, in order to Trump-proof, they have to expand the scope and scale of this conflict. They've convinced themselves that Russia is bluffing. Ray knows that Russia's not bluffing. Ted knows that Russia's not bluffing. I know that Russia's not bluffing. You know Russia's not bluffing. Anybody who follows us knows Russia's not bluffing. But NATO has convinced itself that Russia is bluffing. And now NATO has taken this and sold this notion to the Biden White House. And what's important here is that by keeping the Defense Department out of this dialogue, the one sane voice, the people that know what the consequence will be, weren't participating, didn't get heard. And so Tony Blinken, who we know, and Jake Sullivan, who we know have been leaning over backwards to get this permission, they become the only people advising the president. Whether the president gave the orders or not, we don't know, but the orders were given. And now we found out that Russia isn't bluffing. And this is a major deal. This is a strategic system, even though it's not an ICBM, it's a strategic system. An intermediate-range missile of this capability has never been fired in combat before. This is the first time. And this is a major escalation of a qualitative nature, exactly what Putin talked about. This changes everything. This weapon cannot be intercepted, and this weapon can destroy everything it reaches out and touches in Europe. It's an absolute game-changer, which has prompted, by the way, the United States to rethink its nuclear doctrine, because the United States now is saying, wait a minute, what we thought war was going to be like isn't the way war is going to be. We thought that if Russia was going to intervene at this level, it would be a nuclear intervention, and we have a doctrine in play for this. We don't know what to do when Russia comes in with this conventional strike capacity, which is utterly devastating. And there's no response to it. They don't have a weapon that can counter it, nothing. So this is a game changer in every way. And I guess they still think Russia's bluffing. Right now the thought is that this is an experimental missile. Russia has only one or two examples of it. They fired one. Once they exhaust it, we still have time between now and January 20th to push the envelope, because the goal is to Trump-proof these policies. That is to make relations between NATO and Russia, the United States and Russia, so broken, to break it fundamentally, that Trump can't fix it. Trump can't pursue what he was trying to pursue. That Trump will have to commit to Ukraine, that Trump will have to commit to a policy of confronting Russia. This is Trump proofing the policy, and their goal is to get it done before January 20th. And the only thing I can think is that they don't think that Russia has sufficient systems in place to back up the threat that Putin put out about mirroring their action. We'll find out. France was just given permission to launch the Scout missile, and there's rumors that ATACMS and Storm Shadows continue to fly. So we will soon find out, but we are closer today. And I will tell you this. This is from a Russian diplomat, Dmitry Polyansky, the deputy ambassador of Russia to the United Nations, has said that he agrees with my assessment that we are in a situation today that is far more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis, that we have never been this close to nuclear war in the history of the world.
Well, the ball is in the court of the United States and the West. Both sides have fired now. There's been a few days quiet. You say there are rumors of ATACMS flying, but we would know about that, wouldn't we? Yeah. So have they gotten the message? Maybe the Pentagon is working behind the scenes to get through to them that the Pentagon doesn't necessarily believe Putin is bluffing. And even if he is, you can't take this chance. Maybe that message is getting through. Did this missile get that message through? Maybe not to Blinken, but to somebody who's making the decisions in the White House?
I think what they're looking for right now is for Ukraine to – one of the aspects of the Russian strike was that it hit the old Yuzmash, Soviet-era Yuzmash ballistic missile production facility. It used to produce ICBMs. Today it's been converted for a number of reasons, for a number of purposes, including to try and create an indigenous Ukrainian intermediate-range missile capable of striking deep inside Russia. And that what the United States and Great Britain and others are hoping is that Ukraine can develop its own indigenous system and thereby turn the Russian policy. Because right now Russia says if Ukraine attacks it, then it just is going to deal with Ukraine. But what Russia has said is that that missile that's being developed isn't a Ukrainian missile. It's being built with Western technology designed by the West. It's just being assembled by Ukraine at Yuzmash. Well, not anymore. Yuzmash no longer exists. The reports I've seen is that a large number of the production halls were underground. The Ukrainians were using them, and that this system was able to penetrate and destroy that. If Ukraine isn't able to deploy a long-range system in time for January 20th, I think the pressure is that that they will indeed fire more of these, and they will call Russia's bluff. The West, if you take a look at Russia's statement, Putin's statement, the implication is that he has built in at least an additional round of escalation that will hit only Ukrainian targets. So the West is willing to sacrifice more Ukrainian targets, up to and including Bankova Street, because what Putin said is that he will give advance notice to evacuate civilians from the areas that are being struck. There's no reason for Russia to strike any civilian areas unless they're taking out Bankova Street, that is the seat of government in Kiev. And it appears that the West is willing to sacrifice that as part of this escalation that they have taking place, under the belief that if Russia does hit Kiev, that Donald Trump will not be able to walk away from that. The whole idea here is to get Donald Trump trapped in a quagmire. And but it's a very risky thing, because what happens if Ukraine or the Scout missiles or the Storm Shadows or the ATACMS hit something of value, achieve a significant result? The Russians then may feel compelled to strike. And I'm just saying right now, if I were an American service member in that newly opened Aegis Ashore Mark 41 site in Poland, or the one down in Romania, I wouldn't sleep well, because I think that will be probably the first non-Ukrainian target that Russia will hit.
Ted Postol, you've been looking into these missiles that were fired, and you have some details you could tell us about, and also you could weigh in on the general issues we've been discussing. Ted?
You're muted.
Might be muted. Or he's speaking.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
I'm not sure I have anything tremendously insightful to say after what Scott has said, but I can say that these missile, you know, Scott and I have been trading data, and I've done a little bit of analysis. I'm not sure it's helpful at this moment in this context, but I have charts, but there's no, I don't think it, I don't feel like I should show them it unless people want to see them, maybe later. But basically, it looks like, you know, we have video that various people have taken of the launch of this Oreshkin missile, and we have seen the powered flight of the first stage. We have video of the powered flight of an upper stage that might be called the boost vehicle, and then we have actually video of a third staging event where presumably the various pieces of the of the mechanism, which is looks like it's six independently powered and guided munitions that can deploy submunitions. We have damage photographs of damage on the ground, and based on simple analysis of the kinetic energy and the speed at which these munitions arrive, it would actually be silly for the Russians to put high explosives on these munitions, since their kinetic energy is actually larger than their equivalent weight in TNT. So why would you even bother, you know, wasting explosives or complicating the mechanism of this vehicle? So this is a new vehicle. Some of the claims that it's old stuff is sort of like talking about a steam-driven automobile and comparing it to the most advanced electric vehicle that we build today and saying, well, it's all the same technology. I mean, it's nobody who understands the differences in technology, you know, what technology is about, is going to say this. So I assume that the people who are saying this are simply political people who have been monkeying statements that they've been told to repeat. In fact, if it's not the case, if it's someone who claims to be a technically informed person, I would love to have them talking on an interview with me, so we can really talk about the technologies here in some detail. My point is not to get into details of technology that nobody who's a non-specialist should care about, but my point is to expose the lying, which I think is the real problem. I mean, I don't know if Scott caught the statement made by Putin the other day, but he did say that he had quite a few of additional missiles of this kind that he could launch. Now, of course, he could be lying about it, but I haven't found a single incident where he made a claim about a capability he had, which he didn't have, which incidentally is completely unlike Mr. Biden and Mr. Blinken and Mr. Sullivan, who, as far as I'm concerned, you can't believe anything these guys say, literally nothing. So this man who's supposed to be, you know, Hitler incarnate, and has been demonized beyond belief by people who themselves, their descriptions of him match themselves, not him. He made a statement, and I think he means it, because he's not going to say something in this particular situation and not be able to back it up. I mean, one of the things anybody who knows anything about political situations where the threat of military force is involved is you never make a threat you cannot back up, because that's the worst thing you can do, show that you really don't know what you're doing, which, of course, is repeatedly what Mr. Biden and his crowd has done. So unless somebody wants to come back to me at some point and ask me to show a few slides, I'm not going to bore you with it because, I'm going to be putting something out probably tomorrow, midday, and I'll be sending it out to all the usual suspects, and any of the suspects who don't receive it should let me know, and I'll be sure to send it to you.
What are these slides? What do they show? Briefly, what do the slides show?
Well, what they show is that the system is a very capable system that has the ability to evade interceptors even after launch. The rocket motor appears to make maneuvers. I say appears, I don't have detailed, but you look at the contrail of the rocket motor. It's a single stage taken. It's a modified from an ICBM. I'm guessing it's about 25 tons, I think, is the number I came up with. And it could be 30 tons. It could be 20 tons. This is just a general back of the envelope. It can lift a tremendous payload. 5,000 pounds, and given that Scott has given me some background information that indicates it could be, we certainly have images of six guided and powered canisters that are ultimately launched into a trajectory by the lower stages. So we have those images. Someone took a photograph as these things passed over, and we have images of them coming in Dnipro, and it's quite a fire show, I must say. The sky was lit up in a way that I've never seen. I'm still trying to understand how they got some. It's tricky because it's taken by a camera that's just sitting around monitoring, a view. But the sky is just lit up like meteor, like comets are coming in. And one possibility is the munitions. First of all, the munitions were supposed to be traveling at Mach 11 or 12, somewhere in that region, which means that they have about 1.5 times the kinetic energy of their equivalent weight in TNT, and they may have been covered. It's entirely possible they were covered with a material that was intended to boil off and make them bright in the sky, just to say, look, guys, here we're coming. Add to the terror associated with the attack. I don't know that's true, but I've just never seen anything come in that looks so bright. I know you can get this kind of brightness by simply using material because the heating rates on the surface of the munition are tremendous. So you can boil off this stuff, which will then combust into very bright combusting particles, and you can create a very bright luminous cloud as you come in. And it looks like that was happening. I can't be sure. There was at least one very large secondary explosion that I could see in the video. That doesn't mean there weren't others that I couldn't see, since the brightness of the in the sky was so large. But this was a spectacular display of a weapon system coming in and hitting targets. There was nothing ambiguous about it. So
this is about 2 to 3 kilometers per second. Is that the speed at which it travels?
It's about 3 kilometers per second. About 3 kilometers.
3 kilometers per second.
Yeah.
So whatever
it is. I'm sorry?
Yeah. Obviously, this is a terrifying new weapon. And is the Pentagon, given the analysis you have done in this week, these few days afterward, do they know this? And are they transmitting that?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure that people in the intelligence community who can do this analysis, what I'm pretty sure of also is that the people at the decision-making level have not seen any analysis like this, because before it goes through the system, it has to be vetted, and the bureaucracy is very slow. I had a funny experience. I don't want to give too much detail, where there was a very high-level person at the level, comparable level to the Secretary of Defense, who I was providing analysis to at one time, because it took so long for the intelligence community to get the stuff that I was producing that was basically replicating what I had done, that this person had privately asked that I send the material onto them. So that was during the last Trump administration. So, but I've seen what happens. You know, when I was in the Pentagon myself, I got taken out of. I was in an intelligence brief. In fact, which was usually closed door, and they broke open the door and pulled me out because the chief of naval operations needed some information from me that the intelligence community couldn't provide. So it's not that the community is incapable. It's that it's big and it's slow. And then, more importantly than whether or not it's capable, because I've known plenty of capable people in the intelligence community, the problem is it's corrupt. And it's corrupted at the top. And because it's corrupt at the top, the people at the top can't be sure that they're getting accurate information. And that is the real problem. And that, I hope, someone like Tulsi Gabbard will be able to address when and if she becomes the Director of National Intelligence. And I'm very disturbed about these suggestions that she is in some way a security risk. That is totally ridiculous. And I'm not sure I have more, unless you have some specific questions. I see Ray has this moving his hand.
Ray, are you going to say something, and then Elizabeth will take over for me?
I just want to say that what Ted has just explained, and what I, and many years ago, and what Scott more recently have experienced, is very frightening. Even if there's an honest person in charge, he or she can't be sure they get in the street scoop, because everybody's trying to please everybody else. Witness the fact that the head of the CIA told the president in July of last year that Putin had already lost in Ukraine, and that his troops have been shown to be incompetent, and that had been revealed to the whole world. Where is he getting that stuff? People tell him what he wants to hear. I want to raise a related question, because it has to do with nuclear stuff, and I'm really worried about this. Let me see if I can describe what I think happened here. The Russians gave us forewarning that they were going to shoot this missile. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, 30 minutes or something like that? And they said, this is a new missile. I'm just guessing. This is a new missile, and don't worry about it. It doesn't have a nuclear warhead. And the Pentagon guy says, well, how do you know? Well, yeah, we just trust us. Doesn't have a nuclear warhead. Well, can it fit it? Look, we're just telling you a little bit of advance. It doesn't have one, okay? And, of course, it didn't. But were the conditions reversed? The U.S., the Russians have already said that if there's something nuclear capable, like an F-16 or something like that, if it goes up in the air, they will have to assume that it's got a nuclear weapon, and they're going to shoot that right away, okay? So how many times are the Pentagon people going to say, oh, you can trust the Russians, that first one was not nuclear capable. We don't know if the second one, and then you get people out at SAC, or what it's called now, like Admiral Buchanan, who thinks we can fight and win a nuclear war, for God's sake. So I'm worried about this. Ted and Scott, do we know a little bit more about whether there is a warhead specifically fittable on these things? And if so, what's your take on how much trust the Pentagon will place in the next such firing?
Can I hit that one first?
Yeah, sure.
I have to be careful how I answer this question because of the sensitivity of the subject. But what I can say is in the 1980s, the Arms Control Intelligence staff of the CIA put out technical collection requirements that it needed to do treaty compliance verification. And then as we moved on, additional collection capabilities were acquired that retired. For instance, we used to have these ships that floated in the Pacific Ocean, and we had aircraft that would fly Cobra Ball and things of that nature. But they would photograph reentering warheads and things of that nature. We have replaced them with other systems that have the capability of taking extremely high resolution photographs. And these are systems that are responsive to the tasking, meaning that if you know an event's going to take place in a given location at a given time, these systems can be positioned so that they will collect. The Russians apparently put the launcher on the launch pad 36 hours in advance. Now, why would they do that? This is a mobile launcher that is designed to be fired without detection. But the Russians instead went to Kapustin Yar. Why Kapustin Yar? Because the United States has been collecting on Russian test launches from Kapustin Yar for decades. We know how to collect information from this system, and the Russians know we know how to collect it. So the Russians put this system on the pad oriented towards Ukraine. Oriented towards Ukraine. Normally, Kapustin Yar, you are firing from the east, from the west to the east. This time, it was oriented towards Ukraine, from the east to the west. And it was there for at least 36 hours. We know the United States took photographs because apparently those photographs were shown to the Ukrainians, who then, based upon a physical analysis, an assessment of the physical properties, identified it as a RS-26 Rubiezh. That's a six-axle launcher with a launch canister of given dimensions. Now, here's the thing. Special warheads on certain systems are stored separately and then brought in and mated. On a system like this, if it had a special warhead, it would probably be located on the missile already, meaning that there will be a system for conventional launch and a system for nuclear launch, and there's external factors that allow you to identify those differences. The United States had 36 hours to look at this missile. And that means that if it was a nuclear weapon on board, there are certain security procedures that have to take place in terms of the physical security. The footprint is identifiable. Special units are there. There will be special communication protocols, all of which are detectable, and they weren't there. So this is one way the Russians went, this ain't a nuke, guys. Here it is, 36 hours in advance. Look at it. Look at what's happening around it. This is not a nuclear weapon. The next thing is, this was an experimental missile. Now, this is where I get into some speculation. On a missile like this, the Russians called it a test. When you do a test, you will have telemetry, a lot of telemetry being broadcast from the system to look at things as it's fired so that they can launch it. Now, telemetry under certain arms control agreements will not be encrypted because you are supposed to do it. But this is an intermediate range system. There are no treaties in place regarding encryption. But the Russians may have ensured that the missile was communicating its intent as it is going. There are things that are going to happen in this missile if it's nuclear armed that are different than things that will happen if it's not nuclear armed. And again, the Russians, I believe, were communicating that intent, meaning that there were certain channels that were that could have been encrypted that weren't encrypted. Again, just so the people understood what was happening was consistent with a conventionally armed missile. Then the last thing is the United States would have been tracking this in real time with teams of analysts who specialize in this. And they would have known as it was happening what was happening. Ted, you would love to get the photographs these people took of this system.
Oh, I'm sure I would.
And not just the photographs, but the radar, the MASINT, the everything about this. They, you know, as these warheads turned into plasma, the spectral analysis from above looking at it is different from below because we have atmospheric interference. I'm speculating here just so I don't get in trouble. But I'm just saying that there would be the potential to collect all of this information is there, and the Russians know it. I think the Russians sent the clearest possible signal to the United States via the intelligence community of the capabilities of this missile and of the intent of this missile, meaning it was a conventional strike system from the very beginning, so as to eliminate these. Because the 30-minute courtesy call that was given is just that. It's a courtesy call. There's no real data in there. But to let that system sit on the launch pad, oriented the direction it was for 36 full hours, gave the United States all the time in the world to put all the collection capabilities possible on that system, and they were all on record when the system was launched. And I think the Russians went out of their way to ensure that the United States knew this was not a nuclear weapon. The United States knew that going in. Like I said, there are certain things that have to happen if it's a nuclear weapon, units, the procedures, protocols, et cetera, that aren't happening. And so that's the biggest giveaway. I would also imagine that the Russians, according to the Ukrainians, some of their intelligence came from communications intercepts. And I would imagine that the Russians were able to communicate the concern that this was a nuclear strike. And that's why you didn't see any panic in the West, because they knew damn well exactly what was happening, because the Russians made sure they knew what was happening. That's my take from an arms control intelligence collection perspective.
Well, let me just make a quick comment in support of Scott. We the Americans, and actually the Russians too, have techniques to really construct images of objects from radars. There's a technique called inverse synthetic aperture radar, where you need a very stable radar and the radar screen and a radar beam, and you really must observe the object as it passes through the entire beam from which you then construct an image of it. So it takes time to collect all the information. You know, it may take many seconds as an object at very high speeds passes through the radar beam. But it's well known. It's a well-known technique. It's universally known among electronic engineers who deal with radar, and there's no doubt that the United States has detailed images of anything that was certainly flown into Kamchatka, and they would have had a lot of other information from other sources of the kind that Scott has talked about. But one of the things I'd just like to make a comment about is that the Russians have always shown a tremendous caution with regard to the handling of nuclear weapons. Whenever there has been a situation that could have been ambiguous, they have gone out of their way to make it absolutely clear that they were not involved in doing anything or making any preparations for nuclear use. I don't think that's true of the United States. I don't think we have been as careful. We have done things like fly aircraft into their early warning systems just to test their air defenses. This is the kind of activity that is guaranteed to increase the chances of an accident. So the portrayal of the Russians as extremely aggressive and not concerned about the dangers of nuclear war and nuclear accidents is just not true when you look at the way they behave relative to the way we behave. And I would like to see us start behaving more like the Russians do, because it's really a dangerous situation.
I just want to point out for the FBI, because I know they're watching tonight, that I did not make any reference to synthetic aperture radar, inverse or otherwise, okay? That wasn't me that injected that into the conversation. I'm joking, Ted.
No, that's okay. That's okay, because my experience with security people is they're poorly trained. Fair enough. I had people when I was working as a science advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations, I'd have these characters come in, and they tell me about some new system, new capability that the Russians had, you know, look down radars. And they were talking about standard radar techniques that are universally understood by engineers everywhere in the world. Forget Russia and the United States. And they'd come in and they'd say, oh, this is very secret, Dr. Postel. We want to tell you about this new capability. You should tell the chief about it because, you know, there's a big threat from it. And I'd sit there. I wouldn't say much, to be honest. I just sort of let them talk. But it was quite an education for me, not in terms of learning about new technologies, but learning about how the system functioned. And it makes me very cautious about in fact, I used to have a joke. It was with Ash Carter, who was then an analyst at the same level that I was at the Pentagon, and we were not yet our friendship had not yet terminated. I would always tell Ash, you know, if you're ever in a position to tell anybody who's giving a briefing to the president about nuclear war plans, you make sure that they tell the president, don't do anything that is pre-canned, because you have no idea what's in those pre-canned plans. And just as importantly, the guy who's briefing you has no idea what's in these pre-canned plans. And it's a real problem with this community, because people are always, you know, climbing to get some visibility with people at the upper levels of power. And they don't necessarily, they're not trained, they don't necessarily know what they're doing. I have talked to friends who are very technically trained, who have had high-level jobs for some time, and they've complained, all of them complain about the briefers who have no technical background. And in several cases where I've had to meet with people and tell them, here are the issues you need to talk about, because, you know, if they're not specialized, and then go into the system and find the analysts who are actually doing this work, because you can't get it from the briefers. It's a very dangerous situation.
As a former briefer.
Yeah, but when I talk, you are questioning me about every detail. I mean, I know what kind of briefer you were, because I know how you cross-examine me about every detail, which is the right thing to do. That's when I say to myself, when I first met you, I said, this guy Ray McGovern, he's serious, you know. And I don't think we have those people in the position you are in now.
And I hope you
the evidence is against that.
Sometime, because I missed many a supper interrogating analysts like you or like Scott to make sure that I was at least prepared to, if not answer questions that Reagan's people asked me, then at least I'd know exactly whom to go to and how long to tell my briefee, hey, 2 hours from now, I give you the answer to that. So, yeah, there are, it's really kind of not the same anymore, and that's my concern. I would just say that we have to go back to who's running the ship now. Who's running the ship? It looks very much like Antony Blinken is running the ship. Is he going to listen to intelligence analysts, even if they give him the straight scoop, because they know he may not want it? Well, I don't know. And so that brings me back to Admiral Buchanan out there at SAC, or whatever it's called now. Whom does he rely on? He's the J3, I guess, out there for operations plans and all. J5, okay. So what is he bound to listen to, the kind of cogent analysis, experienced analysis, analytic analysis that has no kind of flavor to it to please anyone? Is he going to listen to that? There are lots of slips between cup and lip in this business, and I'd like to hear your good comment on that.
Well, Scott, did you have something to say? You look like you.
Are you okay, I'll just Scott? Say that on the J5 for nuclear war fighting, he's a prisoner to presidential guidance. Basically, the president will put forward the planning guidance and then the employment guidance. And J5's job is to, if the president says our job is to prevail in a conflict so that the United States maintains global superiority, his job isn't to go, well, we can't do that, boss. His job is to say, well, in order to do that, we're going to have to do X, Y, and Z. We're going to have to employ our weapons here, there, and everywhere. So there's not much analysis there, as he himself admitted in this presentation that's being quoted from, where he delivered a keynote address to the CSIS. He said it's politics. This is all politics. Everything he's talking about is politics. It's not real. You can't start a conversation about nuclear war where you say, let's just all agree at the start that nuclear wars can't be won, and therefore they shouldn't be fought. Sanity. And then he comes out and says, but I've been directed to come up with a scenario where we win a nuclear war. And so therefore, this is the scenario that we built our plan around, but we're not going to win a nuclear war and they shouldn't be fought. That tells you that our nuclear war plan is 100% political. It's not a war plan to, you can't win a nuclear war. So when you think you can, it's not because you've been talking to analysts, it's because you're responding to political guidance. And that's the problem. That's why I encourage everybody, Ted, I don't know if you've read it, but Annie Jacobson's book, Nuclear War Scenario, scared the living you-know-what out of me.
Well, I hope it did, because I spent a lot of time with Annie giving her details.
Well, you succeeded, man, because one of the things that came, that book taught me what I already knew, but it just put it out there in graphic. Yeah. I have to be honest, when she first wrote it, I went, what the hell is a woman going to tell me about nuclear war?
I mean,
then I heard everybody talking about this book, and I went, all right, I'll buy it and I'll read it. I couldn't put it down. And then I was literally shaking when I finished, and I put it down. I said, I got to read it again. And I read it again, and I'm shaking even more. You realize that they don't know what they're doing. None of them know what they're doing, and they're on full automatic. Once the system starts, you can't stop the system, and they don't know what they're doing, and we're all going to die. That's the thing. I mean, normally you'd think you'd have rational players there, but there's no ability to inject rationality. Once the nuclear war system engages, we are on full automatic, and we're all going to die.
When I was in the Pentagon, I was, I guess, a civilian equivalent of a colonel, I guess, with a GS-15. So I wasn't a big shot of any kind. And I had this job. I was called the Assistant for Weapons Technology. And I was in the division, for Theater and Nuclear Warfare Division, in the Chief of Naval Operations. Okay. So, because of an accident of the situation, I would get in to brief the Chief of Naval Operations on a fairly regular basis. And because decisions were often being made on a completely short timeline, I would hand draw my briefing slides, other than having all these rooms and rooms and rooms of people drawing these briefing slides for the chief, and I would always come in with my own. And one of the things I did during this very rewarding and interesting job was I spent quite a bit of time interacting with the Strategic Air Command people and staff. And what impressed me most, especially when I went out to Omaha, was how low the level of understanding of nuclear weapons was on the staff. I would ask questions in meetings, you know, because I'm there, I'm a technical advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. So the Navy, you know, Navy's a significant player. And, I'd come in and I'd have a question about something they're doing. And they had no idea what they were, none. So this is probably not the place to do it, but sometime when we're all having some beers together, I'll tell you some stories about things they were doing. Unbelievable things. They were targeting, trying to target multiple warheads through the cloud stem of a nuclear weapon because there was an artificial computer program they were using. I even remember the name, called Vordum. And in the program, there was a hole that opened up. It was an artifact of the modeling. It had no physics in it at all. There was a hole that opened up in the cloud stem. The cloud stem is the most lethal part of the cloud. If you would never fly a nuclear weapon. And they were targeting nuclear weapons through it. And I'd say, do you know what you're doing? You know? And my attitude was, because although I've always felt, even then, that nuclear weapons were, you know, almost anything we did would get us all killed. So I didn't really think that it would matter in the nuclear war planning. I always took it very seriously because my job was to make sure that the system functioned according to the standards it had set for itself. I was not in a position to make the standards. When I was in a position to raise questions, I did so because I thought it was my duty to the country as well as to my immediate superiors. But people had no idea what these weapons were about. They had no idea about some of the most basic effects. And the idea that Strategic Air Command should, as analysts who know what that the commander can pick up a phone and say, give me a briefing that clearly and unambiguously explains to me what happens when a nuclear weapon detonates. I don't believe there's anyone there who could do it. I just don't believe it. I could do it. Give me a phone call, general, and I'll be out there because I've talked to a lot of 4-star generals over my career and a lot of 3-stars too, and I'll be happy to come out and give you this briefing. In fact, I used to jokingly call it my shake and bake briefing. And people, when I gave that briefing at Stanford, the first time I gave that briefing at Stanford, the people who did the tutorials after the big lecture told me that the students said they were having nightmares after that briefing. And it's not a briefing that just shows a lot of victims. I'm not into that. I just calmly go through the physical effects. Do nothing more than that. And these people were lost sleep over it. And they should have. Means that they understood what I was telling them. Because it is an I still have nightmares about nuclear weapons and their effects. Because it's such an extraordinary thing. It's beyond anything you can imagine.
Well, thanks for helping me sleep tonight, Ted. I really appreciate that.
And the 4,000 people who are watching right now. Elizabeth, would you like to ask some questions? We're going to probably lower this down from the technical point to a more
human level.
Of course.
Human, I was going to say lay person's level. But anyway, Elizabeth.
Yeah, sure. Scott, I wanted to go back to something you said earlier about the current effort by the Biden administration and NATO to Trump-proof the war in Ukraine. And I wanted to ask you, are you saying that they are wanting to drive us as close as they possibly can to World War III if we're not there already, as quickly as they can before the inauguration? Is that what you're telling us?
It's not just what I'm saying, Elizabeth. It's what they're saying. They have had meetings in NATO where they use the terminology Trump-proof. And a lot of this is premised on what they say is that there's a faulty logic to those who have been slow-rolling NATO support to Ukraine. They say that the logic that Russia would respond, Russia would implement a nuclear doctrine is flawed, that Putin is weak, that Putin is not secure in his position, that the Russian military lacks the ability to follow through, that the Russians are scared to do this. And these are emotional assessments made that are so far removed. Again, and Ray can jump in anytime he wants to either correct me or support me, but we don't have Russian experts anymore. That's one of the fundamental problems, is that we don't have legitimate Russian experts. Ray McGovern was a Soviet expert. When Ray McGovern worked at the CIA, he knew the Soviet Union inside and out because that was his job, and he gave solid assessments based upon facts. And they weren't assessments designed to please people. They were assessments designed to inform people. When I was involved in this stuff, the guys I worked with, the guys and gals I worked with, these were the smartest people in the world about the Soviet Union, about Russia. They knew the culture. They knew the history. And more importantly, they knew the people. They studied the people. They met the people. They talked to the people. Jack Matlock is one of the most superb ambassadors the United States has ever had. And he was the second to last ambassador in the Soviet Union. He left right before the August 1991 coup. But the man is brilliant. We don't train people like this anymore. George Connell, Doug England, Roland LaJoy, these are the foreign area officers that advised presidents, advised senators, advised everybody about the military capabilities of the Russians and the Soviets. We don't have these people anymore. You're not allowed to think like this anymore. You have to follow dogma and doctrine. My daughter just graduated from Georgetown University in the master's program at the Foreign Institute. All right, this is it. This is the one that they train all the State Department people on. And they cookie cutter people. They don't want you to think. They cookie cut. It's a cookie cutting process that produces clones, whose job is to fit into a system that doesn't want you to think certain things and think outside the box. But it's not just that. They don't know what they're talking about. The people today that are advising the president, advising anybody, have no knowledge of Russia. I learned more traveling to Russia twice in the last year than they've learned studying their PhDs. They've written PhDs about the autocratic dictatorial nature of Vladimir Putin, the most evil man on the planet. All you have to do is write a PhD about that, and you will get, man, they'll pass you. But God forbid you come in and say Vladimir Putin is, one of the most, amazing, transformative leaders in the modern world. He took Russia from a horrible situation, brought it up here. Let's look at his leadership style and how he operates. Oh, they don't want to know that. So these people don't know any. The people in NATO, they don't know Russia. They don't know the Russian leaders. They don't know the Russian leadership. And so they make these politicized assessments from fact, but from emotion. They are desperate. They are losing. Ukraine is losing. They need continued American financing, material support, political support, American political support to hold Europe together, because you pull American political support, Europe falls apart literally overnight. And the Europeans know this, so they can't let America withdraw, but the fear is that Trump is going to unplug. So this is an existential issue for them. So they have come together, and the terms they use are, we are Trump-proofing NATO, we are Trump-proofing Ukraine, to ensure that Trump can't unplug. And the only way you can Trump-proof is to take us up to the brink of nuclear war. And that's what they're doing, either wittingly or unwittingly. That's what they're doing. There's many of the people, again, because these are politicized assessments, that they don't believe there's going to be a nuclear war. So they don't understand the consequences, or they've not allowed themselves to think of the consequences. But the reality is, again, Dmytro Polyansky, the deputy Russian ambassador to the United Nations, is a very, very smart man. I've met him. I've talked to him. And he says this is the most dangerous situation that has existed in the nuclear era, that we are closer to nuclear war today than at any time, that the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the point that I made and he concurs, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had diplomatic interaction taking place. Kennedy could talk to Khrushchev and was talking to Khrushchev indirectly. We had ambassadors talking, ambassadors visiting. We had ambassadors meeting. We had back channels. We were communicating, and that saved us. That communication created opportunities that then led to solutions to very difficult problems. I don't know how many Americans know this, but Anatoly Antonov, one of the most qualified ambassadors Russia has ever had to the United States, a genuine expert on the United States of America, and the man who negotiated the New START Treaty, so he's an arms control expert, left. He's gone back to Russia. They haven't replaced him. Now, they have a deputy ambassador. I think I've met him. He's a very capable man. But my point is that the ambassador is not here. Why? Because for 7 years he was here and nobody talked to him. For 7 years he was here and nobody talked to him. And the Russians have just given up. We don't talk to the Russians. When was the last time Tony Blinken picked up the phone and called Sergei Lavrov? I don't think it ever happened. The point, Jake Sullivan's not talking to his counterpart. We have William Burns talking to his counterpart, but that's, you know, intelligence to intelligence. We're not communicating at a time when we have to communicate. Now is the time for communication. But you can't communicate unless you're programmed to accept, to at least listen to what the other side said. We refuse to listen. We refuse to listen. We don't want to hear. We want to dictate. We want to lecture. But we don't want to listen. Therefore, there is no communication. And that means we're not going to find a way out of this when the time comes. And that's why this is the most dangerous period. We are moving closely to the point. Look, the Russians have already said, and I'll leave it with this. Vladimir Putin laid out a new nuclear doctrine. And I read it and I went, well, hell, that's already been violated. And Peskov said the same thing. You've already crossed our red line. If we wanted to legally, we could use nuclear weapons against you. But we're showing restraint. And that scared me because I'm like, wait a minute. Guys, you understand that you've already crossed the red line. Doctrinally, Russia could use nuclear weapons against us. And they don't care. They see Russian restraint as Russian weakness. So they're going to double down and keep pushing and pushing and pushing until the Russians say, we can't yield anymore. That's why they fired the Oreshnik missile, because they couldn't yield anymore. But at some point in time, they'll have to fire the Oreshnik with nuclear weapons because they can't yield anymore. And as Annie Jacobson said with Ted Postol's outstanding advice, 72 minutes after that first nuclear warhead goes off, it's all over. We all die. It's it. That's where we're at right now. This is crazy.
Go ahead, Ray.
May I try to attenuate the nightmares that are going to happen after this session right now? I, of course, agree with everything that Scott and Ted have said, except I'm trying to play the devil's advocate here. Putin's in a situation where he's virtually won in Ukraine. Putting myself in his shoes, my idea would be to hang on. Just hang on until 20 January when this new guy comes in. God knows what that will bring, but it'll be different, okay? And so if the TACMs can go 190 miles into my country, and we'll remove some of the aircraft and everything else. And if these Storm Shadow and now even Scalp from France, they're going, they're pinpricks. And actually, we're gonna shoot down most of them. So, you know, we can tolerate this stuff. We've shown how we can react. But We're going to be circumspect, and as Ted has emphasized, how careful Russians are to avoid any appearance that they're going to use a nuclear weapon. So where does that leave Storm Shadow, Attackum's scalp? And I don't know about it. I'd like to hear comments about whether the Germans will backfire on or go back on the Taurus missiles. It seems to me that even though these are in some ways an embarrassment to Putin, that he sees himself as being deliberately provoked. He won't be provoked into doing something that could cause a nuclear exchange if he can help it. And what is it, only, what, 7 more weeks before the new guy comes in? Maybe that's a complacent attitude, because we are, as Dmitry Polyansky said, it's worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I was around for that, okay? So, I don't know. There's that attenuating circumstances. And the last one is simply that there is a hotline, okay? Now, it's not been used very often, but as far as I know, it still exists. It's between Lloyd Austin, our Secretary of Defense, and Belousov, the Minister of Defense in Moscow. Okay, it's been used to good effect in the past. I don't have any information that it's been shut down. So there's a relief valve as I see it. As long as these two guys can keep talking, as long as Austin is appropriately chastened by his being dissed or excluded from these decisions, they know what nuclear war is like. I'm hopeful that this is just not just a grasp at a silver lining, but a real effect here. Whereas in Cuba, as Scott rightly points out, 1962, we not only had Kennedy and astute advisors, one footnote here, John Kennedy insisted that Ambassador Llewellyn Thompson, the best Soviet expert we had in those days, sit in on every one of the important conferences that took place there where they decided how they were going to respond to Khrushchev's emplacement of missiles in Cuba. So that doesn't exist now, okay? And I'm not sure that anybody as objective and as experienced as Ted or Scott have been able to get to the people who make these decisions. So it's a mixed bag in my view. And, you know, I'd like to hear further comments on that as to whether I'm being naive or whether there is hope that we get through these next 7 weeks.
Well, I think that Putin is the adult in the room. When you listen to him talk, he just gave a statement, some of the statements he made just before this attack occurred and essentially immediately after the attack occurred. He very carefully and systematically connected the nature of this attack, the Dnipro attack and the weapon, with the loss of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. He made that clear. He made it clear that the Russians were refraining from deploying these weapons as long as the Americans would refrain. He did point out that the Americans were causing problems with what they were doing also in the Pacific with China. And he did make it clear that he thought something needs to be done in the form of some kind of understanding, treaty, whatever you want to call it. And so he connected all the dots, not just with regard to the war in Ukraine, but with regard to the larger issue of nuclear stability in the world. The problem on the American side is we have a president who is, I just can't begin, who's reckless and who's lost, maybe never had the common sense that I would have hoped that someone in his position and his background would have. But frankly, if the political system were working, which of course it's not, he would be impeached right now. I mean, people in the Congress would be aware of what's going on, which they are not, would be aware of the danger that he's recklessly putting the country in front of, you know, making for the country, and they'd have him removed. You know, it's just, you know, when Richard Nixon was, losing it, you know, the people in the cabinet went and talked to each other and reached agreements. They talked to the military leadership.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I coughed. I apologize.
Go ahead. No, if you want to disagree. All right.
No.
So when Trump was at the end of his presidency and people were worried that he would do something rash, people coordinated at the highest levels of the military. And I don't know if his cabinet did, but certainly at the highest levels of the military. I'd be very surprised if people in the military are not coordinating in great detail in the Pentagon now, along with Austin. And it's not a way to run a country, or for that matter, protect the world from a disaster. But there are things that could keep us from going over the edge. And it's just the knowledge that these weapons will bring about with near certainty the end of the world. That knowledge has probably kept us from having a nuclear war over and over again when you look at the incidents we've had over the Cold War, beyond that of the, we always look at the Cuban Missile Crisis, but there was Abel Archer. You know, there were all kinds of other things where KAL-007, the people were at it. There were all kinds of things that would have gone over the edge if people didn't have in the back of their mind that the world is going to be ended if we make the next step. So I think if you look at, if you I'm an analyst, so I come up with these silly ideas, but if you took a statistical look at the Cold War and you asked, could we get through it using sort of common sense probability judgments, you'd say, absolutely not. We're going to annihilate ourselves. But we got through it, not because it was because of luck, of course, that played a big role, but also because the probability distribution for bad decisions was skewed against the use of nuclear weapons, because people understood in one way or another that it was the end of the world. And I'm hoping that that fear will continue to hold us together until the end of this administration. But, you know, you got a guy like Blinken, I don't think he has a clue what he's doing. I think the man is so arrogant. He is such a high level of sense of how much he knows relative to everybody else, that he's incapable of learning. He's a functional idiot. And I'm in academia. I see them all the time, functional idiots. So, you know, these people that, you know, you could do arithmetic very well, so you know everything. Well, no, not quite true. So they're functional idiots everywhere, and we have these guys like Blinken. He's just a functional idiot. You know, I understood. I had one experience with McGeorge Bundy. I was in a meeting at MIT of all places, and people were discussing something. It was really a serious issue, and I tried to say something to McBundy, and he did not even acknowledge that I was in the room talking to him. You know, he was so enthralled with his complete knowledge and understanding of everything that was going on. In that instant of time, I learned something that I hadn't appreciated earlier, that the guy was functionally an idiot, because although he had intellect, he was totally closed to any kind of information that could inform him. And that's how you could, you know, if you look at the man, you know, he writes these erudite books that are totally out of touch with anything. And, you know, all this Cold War theories and stuff. And yet he was functionally an idiot. And that's what you have. You have these people who are functionally idiots. And you have a lot of them.
Thank God I've never enrolled in one of your classes because.
No, you would have done very well. You would have done very well in my class.
No, I'm a functional idiot. Trust me, I acknowledge it.
I would tell people in my class, I would start out by saying there are only two things you can do wrong in this class. First, you cannot. If you're afraid to answer a question that looks extremely stupid, you're wrong. You should be able to ask that question. And the other thing is, if somebody asks a question that looks like that, and you attack them or make fun of them in any way, that's absolutely unacceptable. You're out of this class. This is a class where we discuss everything. And I had one student ask me a question like, "What is the Terence?" Well, gee whiz, you know, that was a pretty profound question. And I told that student, this is a profound question, because I can show you dozens of political scientists who talk about deterrence like it's some kind of physical law, you know, like it's a law of the universe. And, you know, you listen to these people and you say, how can these people be so dumb? So you would have done very well in the class because you would have asked some tough questions, and that would have been the right thing to do.
That's Marine questions, simple questions.
That's right. But,
I do want to.
I like the Marines because of that.
About you know, because Ray injected hope, and Ted, you know, doubled down on the potential of hope. But as I'm sure you both know, I'm just saying this for the benefit of the audience. Okay, let's say we survive up until January 20th, and Donald Trump comes in. He is operating under the premise that he can pick up the phone or he can send somebody or something and get the Russians to respond in a radical, dramatic fashion to his imperative, to his initiative. And that shows an absolute ignorance about not only how Russia works, but the influences on Russia. You know, the last time Russia underwent had a leader that did radical policy changes without adequately consulting with the system. Russia's Soviet Union is a very big place. Things don't happen that quick. It is like a giant ship. It gets momentum. It moves. And to change the trajectory, you have to begin to make inputs in to make it move. Gorbachev destroyed the Soviet Union. Destroyed in terms of the military economy and then the rest of the economy, because he implemented unilateral decisions into a system that wasn't prepared to act on it. He injected decisions about what, you know, stopping production. You know, when I was at Vodkinsk, and I didn't have perfect knowledge of it then, but I have pretty good knowledge of how it works now. And you don't have a city that is literally a factory town where everything is linked to the factory. So the factory pays the salaries, the factory builds the schools, the factory stocks the stores, the factory does the cultural events. Everything's paid by the factory, which means you have this delicate economic balance taking place that the factory manager has to, you know, factor in ballistic missile production, not what we're just doing now, but what we're going to be doing in the future. We have to have contracts out there. We have to make sure we have the people trained for this. We have to have the machine tools ready to do all this stuff. It's very complicated, and it takes a lot of lead time. And if you're going to make an adjustment, you have to give them time to adjust accordingly, or else you get collapse. And Gorbachev came in, signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which got rid of, in the case of Vodkinsk, SS-20 production, SS 12 production, SS-23 production, and then what people don't realize is it also got rid of the Skorost missile, the Courier small ICBM. It gutted. I mean, it took out five major systems, all of which were needed to keep the economy going, and left it with, you know, the SS-25 and some follow-on. Not enough work to keep the factory going, not enough. Then when he changed the, he went to cost accounting, Kurzweil Schultz, I think it was called, in 1990. That means that you went away from state planning. You had to make money and pay your salary based on what you made. The factory couldn't pay anybody because they weren't making any money because the Soviet Union canceled all the missile contracts. They had no money to pay anybody, and everything starts to collapse. Now imagine you do that across the country, and you understand what happened when Gorbachev implemented perestroika. He destroyed the country. And then Yeltsin came in and was trying to recover from the disaster of the collapse of the Soviet economy and the Soviet policy. Putin today has rebuilt Russia in a manner that never again allows those mistakes to be made. The way Putin has built Russia today is based upon Vladimir Putin traveling to oblast, meeting with governors, having conversations with governors, taking that conversation back to committees who review what the governor said, advise the president, who comes back to the governor, and it's a collective decision that, and the governor, meanwhile, is meeting with his people. And the bottom line is everybody's on the same page. The system is functioning. You're not going to come in and tell Vladimir Putin, I need you to change everything to appease me so that I can get the political result I want in Ukraine. Isn't going to happen. So anybody that expects the Russians are going to, A, do something to appease Putin, Trump, or B, would even consider it. And this is where Trump needs experts. This is where Trump needs people who know Russia and explain to him that what you're doing is doomed to fail. And that's the problem. Trump will not succeed in his Russian policy because Russia will not self-destruct to appease Trump. If Trump understood Russia, understood what would be needed to get the changes he wants, and had diplomats in place who were doing the preparatory work, but it will take months, if not years, of concerted, informed diplomacy capable of making compromises to work out the situation where the Russians might be willing to do something for Trump. But then the Russians have to ask themselves, what happens after Trump? He's a four-year president. Who comes after that? What are the guarantees that things we begin with Trump, because you're not going to finish it. You're not going to finish any meaningful arms control treaties. You're not going to finish anything meaningful at all. Is J.D. Vance going to be the president? Do they have confidence in J.D. Vance? So the Russians aren't in the business of making these radical moves. Russia is going to be the ship moving with this steady momentum, and that's the reality that America has to adjust to, and I don't think Trump can. And I'm concerned what happens when a Sebastian Gorka tells Donald Trump, just tell Putin you'll double down on weapons shipments. That if Putin doesn't do what you want, you're just going to open the floodgates and pour weapons into Ukraine. And then they may look back and say, yeah, and that includes longer range systems. We'll give you a standoff missile so you can strike Russia deeper. And Trump will go, okay, because he has a national security advisor who's inclined to think like that, a secretary of state who's inclined to think like that, a secretary of defense who's inclined to think like that. The only sane voice might be Tulsi Gabbard, who says, hey, excuse me, Mr. President, that might lead to thermonuclear war tomorrow. but again, Tulsi has to be backed up with Russian experts. There's no Russian experts in the system, none. And Tulsi's not a Russian expert. And so I'm really concerned that this president's going to get bad advice and act on improper political impetus, misread the Russians, and we're going to war. I did a meme. I don't normally do memes, but I've become attuned to the internet. In the lead up to the election, where I just basically fed off of the Avengers movie, Infinity Wars and Endgame, but one in 14 million chance to save the world. That was Iron Man's thing with Doctor Strange. So I did a meme, and it was, you said we had, 1 in 14 million chance to save America. Is this it? And then in the end, Iron Man, when he snaps his finger, instead of saying, I am Iron Man, he says, I am voting for Donald Trump. But that means it's a 1 in 14 million chance that voting for Trump doesn't guarantee any outcome. In fact, the outcome is likely that we're going to have a nuclear war because Donald Trump is advised by bad people and he's picked bad people and they don't know Russia. There's a 1 in 14 million chance, but Putin's not going to sit there and change everything he does for that 1 in 14 million.
Look, I agree that the future looks terrible for the American government and the American people because this American government has fallen apart. But I also think that the Russians are not stupid and they want to survive. And this doesn't mean that will happen. I want to be clear. It doesn't mean there won't be a series of accidents that nobody can stop once things get going. But this guy Putin is just he's an extraordinarily strategic thinker. I mean, this attack, the use of this weapon, which came out of nowhere. I mean, he understood it. It didn't, not for him, but and the connection between INF and the implied threat about the problems with escalating the Ukrainian war and all of that sort of the web of connecting issues that he put together in his statement from the Kremlin. I mean, he is the adult in the room right now. Now, we have the first task at hand, in my view, is to survive the leadership of this infantile, reckless moron of a president and his infantile, reckless moron of a secretary of state. I mean, these people are just outright dangerous. I mean, it's just, I know it sounds rude beyond what, you would like to, how you would like to describe people in civil debate, but I don't know how else to describe these people. When you put the whole country at risk, I mean, this is a man who knew, he had to know years ago that something was going on with his nervous system. He has physicians who are very highly qualified. They would have detected this condition, that whatever he has, very early, before it was apparent to people like you and me when we saw him, having problems. And yet he was prepared to try to manipulate the American people into reelecting him for four more years, when the chances he would have known that the chances of him being a competent leader in the next 4 years were near zero. He's already shown a complete lack of competence. This is the kind of man we're dealing with as a president. And this is the kind of Secretary of State we have. I was thinking like of Rudolf Hess, at the Nuremberg trials, they tried and convicted people who were tried and convicted simply because they carried out the orders of the state, because knowing that what they were doing was a crime against humanity and also a crime against the German state. I mean, what these people did were crimes against the German state. I mean, you go to Germany now and people look at these people and say, look what they did to our country. I think that's the way Netanyahu's going to look 10 years from now. 10 years from now, if there's an Israel, I hope there will be, but I also hope there'll be a two-state solution. People, Israelis who have any brains at all, and there are lots of them who do, are going to look at this guy Netanyahu and said he did to Israel what Hitler did to Germany. He's destroyed our society. And, but that's the situation we're in now. And I'm just hoping that Putin is competent enough and he can control the people around him who are very angry, and I'm not so sure as competent, you know, to keep doing from doing something really stupid. What he did here was quite intelligent. Now, whether, you know, the people he's dealing with are smart enough to understand what he's showing them, I don't know. I just don't know.
Going back to something you, Scott, and also Ray were talking about, which is the critical importance of communication. And Scott, you've already kind of preempted this a little bit, but is there any chance that Trump right now has some sort of back channel to Moscow and, you know, while taking into account the pretty awful picks that Trump seems to have made across the board, is there any chance that there's some sort of conciliatory discussion being had that might give us a little bit of hope as well? And you feel free to dash any hope I'm bringing up here, by the way.
I don't think there's any chance that Trump's having a back channel with Russia, not because Trump might not want one. The Russians aren't going to do it. The Russians are so careful right now not to be seen as interfering in American domestic politics, and they understand that Joe Biden is the president and that their communication will be with Joe Biden and only Joe Biden. Donald Trump is not the president. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't find some sort of intermediary, but it would be very, very risky right now to have. I think what the Russians are probably doing is what I would call the art of the indirect approach. Sending communications through different channels, communications, you know, the art of declaratory statements, where you make a statement. If you want to communicate with Trump, you don't go to Trump because that's impossible to do right now, but you make a statement that you hope Trump's listening to, that sort of thing. But the idea that there's a Trump guy in Moscow right now sitting down with a Kremlin guy, I don't see that at all. And that's based upon my conversation with Russian leaders and Russian political scientists about the sensitivity that Russia has towards being seen as interfering with domestic American politics.
Of course, and obviously, if information to that effect ever came out, of course, the Western press would have a huge field day. It would be Russiagate 2.0 immediately. All of that. Talking about the leadership and the ignorance of the leadership as to Russia, Scott, you're talking about the fact that there are not Russian experts at hand right now in the way that they were in previous decades. Is that the main reason that we seem to be so numbed to the effects of nuclear war? Why is our leadership right now seeming to be totally oblivious to the dangers of nuclear war that you have all been speaking about this evening already?
Maybe Ted can start off with that one.
Well, I think that people think that nuclear war is a bad thing, of course, in very generalized terms. But the problem is that they don't have a detailed knowledge to give them. It's an abstraction. And I had a very interesting series. I talked about this talk that, my black humor comes out that I talk my shake and bake talk. And I had several instances where military officers that were visiting Stanford, because I gave it, it was a big lecture hall, and came up after the lecture. And they were very upset. And of course, they're soldiers, so they're polite, unlike students, unlike other students. And they said, I had no idea that this was the situation. But keep in mind that this talk I give is very deadpan. People, part of the shock is that I'm just an analytic. Here's what the burn looks like. Here's how it occurs. Here's a fireball. And in the several cases where these young soldiers came up to talk to me, it turned out that they had been on the targeting staff before they went off to Stanford on their next, and the people on the targeting staff, I knew the people on the targeting staff because I'd worked with them when I was in the Pentagon. And they have this circle, and there's a map, and they move the circle around the map, you know, to make sure I include these different targets in the ground zero associated with the weapon of this yield and the targets of this hardness. And they have no idea. You know, they're soldiers. They're very capable at what they do. If they're flying an airplane, driving a tank, commanding a ship, these are very capable people. But they really have no training in the effects of nuclear weapons. I saw that when I was in the Pentagon. I went to a briefing, I remember. it's not funny, but at some level you get used to it. These morons got up. It was a big colloquium. And these guys got up, some contractors, and they postulated a 9-megaton warhead, a warhead from a Titan II ballistic missile, basically detonating at an optimum altitude over the Kremlin. And then they described how some people who are at the edge of Red Square in a kind of basement shelter would be running with their hands an oxygen pump, you know, and they'd be under, and I remember coming out of the briefing, and one of the officers I worked with, really had wonderful colleagues, military officers, and he turned to me and he said, "Ted, isn't that crazy? Don't these guys know about Hiroshima?" And I said to him, "You know, Doug, it's more crazy than you ever could imagine, because these guys would be in the hole, the radiating hole. It wouldn't have anything close to what it looked like at Hiroshima." The point is that people sat through this briefing, which was a joke. I mean, you'd want to get up and scream, "How can you be so stupid, so ignorant? The government's paying you top dollar to spread this kind of absolute nonsense. It doesn't have the status of being wrong." I mean, it's just so ridiculous. It's just pathetic. And you know, this is what people in the government are subjected to. So one of my views that I developed, and I talked about in academia when I had students in my classes, is that people who are inside the government who have clearances should be looked upon to a first approximation as indoctrinated. They don't necessarily know. I mean, people say, "Well, they have all these clearances, they must know something." Not necessarily true. Smart ones who are really well educated, who are serious, who read a newspaper and understand the difference between something that comes out of the CIA that's not been properly refereed, that hasn't been, shaped by the bureaucratic positions of different agencies. If you're a sophisticated reader of intelligence, you can learn a lot. I learned a tremendous amount when I was in the Pentagon. But believe me, I didn't believe anything I saw at face value. Nothing. You know, I would sit late at night in a cage. It was literally a barred cage, reading classified documents that I knew had been checked for their technical accuracy by some kind of process. I never took what, you know, was being generally briefed around as true. I went to those things because I wanted to understand what people were being told. So, for example, I went to a course. It was called, Soviet Awareness Course, something. And I listened to the people in this course. And, you know, I grew up in an immigrant community, so I knew people from all over the world. Many of them were Russian immigrants, you know. And, you know, I mean, it was hard to believe. And this, you know, this was an indoctrination. It had nothing to do with anything that could tell you anything at all about what Russia was about. And I wasn't sure that this was going to be what I saw in the course, but I was suspicious. And I went to the course because I knew it would be a waste of time in terms of learning anything about Russia, which I actually knew quite a lot about because I had done a lot of reading. I knew Russians, but I wanted to understand what was being told to people. And you know, having a clearance is just an opportunity for you to be indoctrinated. It doesn't mean you know anything that's right. And, you know, very intelligent people who are very broad in their education can learn a great deal from the intelligence community, but not run-of-the-mill. Looks like Ray has something to say.
And I just wanted to go back to what I see as the main problem here, and that is whether Tony Blinken is running our foreign policy with or without resort to telling the president what's going on. You mentioned McGeorge Bundy as well during Vietnam. Maybe people in the audience should know that he was the dean of Harvard College. He was literally the best and the brightest, and he wrote all his books that you said, but he didn't know from nothing, okay? So here it is. We have a really good PBS thing. Huntley and Brinkley, okay? McNamara writes his confession, oh, you're wrong, terribly wrong. And McNamara and Mac Bundy and several other people are there being interviewed, which never happens anymore. And so Brinkley asks McBundy, now, McGeorge Bundy, tell me, on the Bay of Tonkin, how did you finally get Congress to approve the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which kind of leashed the war? And he said, oh, it was really a tough morning. I was sitting at my desk, and LBJ comes in, and he says, okay, Mac, and now we got the goods on him. And I said, Mr. President, it's not really certain that second attack happened. Mac, are you going up to the Congress to sell that bill, or you're not? Brinkley, what'd you do? McGeorge Bundy, oh, I went up and sold it, and we succeeded. Now, there wasn't a trace of shame. There wasn't a trace of, well, I could have done something else. He just did it. Now, was he going to be out on the streets of Washington with his hat out, playing a violin or something? No, he's the dean of Harvard College, for God's sake. So that's what happens when you're close to power or whether you're in power or, as I suspect Tony Blinken is, almost complete power. So we have the best and the brightest, Tony Blinken. What are we going to do? I think we have to make it really clear that we fear what can happen now in these next 2 months. And Scott, you have this initiative that you had on the spur of the moment advocated December 7th. Do you want to say a little word about that? Because I'd be really interested in where that stands.
Sure. It's I was doing a show literally, I mean, not even a week ago, where we were talking about this, and I finished the show, and I was so enraged, and I felt powerless, and the Marines don't like to feel powerless, so I said, how will I empower myself? And Marines always go on the offensive. And so on my very next show, I just spontaneously said, I'm going to have a rally in Washington, D.C., to say no to nuclear war. And everybody thought that was a good idea. So I've been working with a lot of people. I will tell you that on short notice, trying to do a live rally in Washington, D.C. is next to impossible. And so we've taken, discretion is the better part of valor. We are going to have a indoor rally. I keep the word rally just to save face. So people say, well, you said there was going to be a rally. Yes, so it's going to be an indoor rally now. But we're going to rent a conference hall and actually put on three world-class panels. Ray, you're invited. Ted is invited, and many others are invited. The panels will be discussing the clear and present danger of nuclear war as the first panel. The second panel will discuss, and we're going to bring in people for each panel, how do we get Biden to stop? What can happen between now? You know, what can be done between now and January 20th to put the brakes on Biden? And the third one is, where's MAGA? I mean, MAGA voted for this guy Trump. He said he was not going to go to war. He said he was looking to get out of Ukraine. He said he was looking to ratchet down tension with Russia. Where's MAGA? As we are being frog marched to war, at a time when the American people said we don't want to go to war, and the people that we elected not to take us to war are silent as we're being led to war. Where's MAGA? And so we're going to address these issues to, one, educate the American people about the danger of nuclear war, to empower the American people to do something, because I do believe there are some initiatives. December 7th is one day. On December 5th, I believe, Thursday, we're going to be doing a congressional intervention, a constructive one, but we are going to engage members of Congress who may have some ideas on what can be done to put the brakes on Joe Biden's headlong rush to nuclear war with Russia. And then on December 7th, we will have this this indoor rally, which is going to be live streamed. We're going to encourage people to come. I think we're looking for a venue that can sit several hundred, maybe even up to a couple thousand. It's going to be a press event, meaning we're going to put out a press release. The quality of the panels should attract press attention, but the idea is to create momentum, to empower people, to educate them about just how dangerous the situation is. I think a lot of Americans right now are waking up saying, it can't be that bad, I woke up. You know, if there was a nuclear war, I'd be dead. Well, don't worry, if there is a nuclear war, you will be dead. But the point is, we don't want there to be a nuclear war. We don't want this to be about a hope and a prayer. We want to actually put in place systems and procedures and processes that can stop a nuclear war. And we need to stop it right now because it's going to happen. And we are on the fast track towards a nuclear conflict. So I want to impart that. I want to empower people with what they can do. Hopefully we can get some congressional representatives to participate and talk about initiatives, get the people to let their voices be heard. And then it's a direct challenge to MAGA. What the hell are you going to do about this? You won an election based on the premise that you weren't going to let this happen. And it's happening right now. That man in the White House is sticking the thumb in your eye. He's saying, I don't care what the American people said on November 5th. I don't care that, you know, the American people want something different. I don't care about the American people. And I'm willing to kill them all to achieve my political fantasy of Trump-proofing something. Where is Donald Trump? Where are the people that surround him? Where is MAGA that did this? And it's a direct challenge to MAGA. You have to step up or you're not going to be president, Mr. Trump. You're going to be dead like everybody else. Just because you got elected, just because you think you're all high and mighty right now, number 47, just because you're appointing cabinet picks left and right in this little self-empowerment exercise, it all gets evaporated along with the rest of the world when the nuclear weapons fly. And if you don't stand up and say something, they're going to fly. So that's the idea. And then on December 8th, the next night, it's the anniversary of the signing of the INF Treaty. And so I have a book, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, which is about the INF Treaty and the implementation of it. And I think there it is. And Busboys and Poets, we're going to have a book event. And it's going to be a very interesting book event because the first half of it will be a discussion, a moderated discussion about the INF Treaty, the consequences of It's a failure. I mean, remember, as Ted said, Putin said, we wouldn't have fired this missile if there was an INF treaty. This missile's banned under the INF treaty. Donald Trump, you withdrew from the INF treaty. You're responsible for us making this missile. I mean, literally, he said, it was a foolish mistake on your part. And then here's the part that I think will be almost even more valuable, because when people think of treaties, they think of pieces of paper, they think of diplomats, they think it's human beings that make treaties work. And so I'm going to be joined on the stage by at least two other former weapons inspectors from the INF treaty, and we're going to have a discussion about what it was like to do this, what it was like to implement this treaty, the roles we played, et cetera. It's not going to be a policy discussion. We're not going to get into, you know, Ukraine and all this stuff. We're just going to talk about the nuts and bolts of taking something that had never been done before and getting it done when so many people didn't want us to get it done. And yet we succeeded. And so it's going to be a wonderful night to try and inject into the public narrative the essential nature of arms control. Ladies and gentlemen, if there was an INF treaty today, we wouldn't be in this situation today. The INF treaty saved us in the 1980s and 1990s, saved us from a nuclear war that would have happened had we not signed the treaty. The treaty's gone today, and we see the ramifications. We are headed towards a nuclear war because there is no treaty. We don't have arms control. The New START treaty expires, I think, in February next year, or the year after. It's we are in the middle of an arms race, a modern arms race, and the nuclear weapons today are terrifying. If you think the Oreshnik is terrifying, understand, put nuclear weapons on that and see what happens. We need arms control. We don't have arms control. Nobody's even talking about arms control. And so I think, as important as December 7th is, and it's a very important event, December 8th is equally important, because we need to inject into the mainstream dialogue the absolute necessity of arms control and disarmament if we hope to survive as the human race. And so that's what's going on from the 5th to the 8th of December. I'm trying to put together a little campaign to stop a nuclear war. The hashtag is no to nuclear war. And we are going to make this happen. This is happening. If you can come to Washington, D.C., we will be publishing where this place is. We want to fill this venue. We want you there. We want you to listen. We want you to talk. We'll take your questions. We're going to inform you. But if you can't make it, we're going to stream it. It's going to be online. Watch it. Learn from it. Live it. And then become empowered by it and do something about it, because this war is going to happen if we don't find a way to stop it. And we're not going to find a way to stop it unless enough of us come together and demand that it be stopped and turn our voices into action. And that action brings results. If you just sit on your asses, excuse my language, you're going to die. And it's that simple, ladies and gentlemen. If you sit on your asses, you're going to die. I have chosen not to die. I will not go gently into that good night. I am going to rage against the dying of the light. Sorry, I had to throw my little Dylan Thomas poetry there, but that's just the way I am. I'm not going to do it, and I'm encouraging everybody else not to want to die too.
Well, Scott, I was going to – yes, go ahead, Ray.
No, I was just going to say, I like Marines when they go on the offensive. As long as Major Ritter is one of the leaders. So I completely endorse what's going on here. This is serious stuff. I've been around a while. It's never been so bad. You don't have to listen to diplomats from other countries to warn you about that. I've seen it. I've seen how close we came in 1983 with Abel Archer. A friend of mine was instrumental in getting the U.S. to tone it down because the Russians thought it was the same. It was the real thing. That was a nuclear warfare exercise. So we've come close. We're never closer than we are now. What Scott says is absolutely true. We need to get off our derrieres and do what we can, no matter what no matter how inconsequential it seems to us, we need to get in touch with everybody we know, get them out there, get them listening, get them educated, because, you know, we need to be winter soldiers, and it will be winter on December 7th, which is the anniversary of some other thing that happened, right? So please, please listen.
I'm sorry to say that this recklessness that we're experiencing now is not the first time. Abel Archer was, if I'm not wrong, was a exercise that they normally would inform the Soviets of the exercise. This time they decided not to and see what would happen. Isn't that right, Scott? And it nearly triggered a nuclear exchange. So I was going to end with the – yes, go on.
No, I was just going to say Abel Archer is – I mean – we were just going to test nuclear warfare communications protocols. So we attached – Abel Archer was an exercise to put on the end of Autumn Forge, which was the big reforger exercise, reforger's return of forces to Germany. And so, you know, we had what at that time I think 300,000 forces in Germany. And if the balloon went up, we were going to fly in another 250,000, 300,000. They'd flow in over the course of 10 days. And land and fall in on pre-positioned equipment, then head off to their combat positions to fight the Soviets. And we'd also fly in aircraft. And on this one, Autumn Forge, it was quite a big exercise. You never fly in everybody, but they flew in, you know, a number of divisions. And the Russians were looking at it going, there's a lot of guys here now. And they're all getting in their tanks, and they're all moving up to their combat positions, and they have airplanes out there, and it's just a lot of activity going on right now. Could they be thinking about doing a preemptive attack against us? And then they get the information, there's this nuclear weapons communication thing going on, and they went, you know, they could be ordering the launch. We have to be ready. They panicked. So SS-20 missiles were put on operational standby. That means they were put out there, nuclear warheads on, ready to go. They were in the field. Airplanes were on strip alert with nuclear weapons underneath of them, ready to launch. And all it would have taken is a mistake. And as Ray said, I actually believe that mistake would have been made, except somebody got in there and said, hey, boss, the Russians think we're getting ready to attack them, and so they're getting ready to launch nukes. And they went, really?
Yeah. There was somebody. He's a good friend of mine. His name is Mel Goodman. Soviet Affairs for decades. He was a division chief in the Soviet analysis group, and he went to his boss, Robert Gates, and he said, they're just bluffing. It's not part of my job, Jar, to make the Russians feel comfortable. Get out of here. So, to his credit, and that's what we need, people with guts. Mel went around Gates, went right to the arch-Russophobe, Bill Casey, head of the CIA. He said, Mr. Casey, sorry to interrupt you here, but it looks like the Russians are taking this very seriously. They've got all these things lined up. They've got the nuclear weapons on their aircraft. They've got the SS-20s ready. They think because you and Vice President and the Secretary of Defense are supposed to be participating in this tomorrow, they think it's the real thing. We're worried sick, okay? Casey says, thank you very much. They leave. Next thing they know, Casey's in his car going down to the White House. He got it toned down, okay? They took them seriously. Bud McFarland was the National Security Advisor. Oh, yeah, I guess we tried to. I guess we got their attention. Maybe we went overboard. Casey says, yeah, you did go overboard. Now tone it down. Now, so I'm saying that not because Mel Goodman is my friend, but because there are precious few people with that kind of fortitude, with that kind of guts that would risk their career. And indeed, Mel had to go work for he's a professor at the National Defense University for a while after that, because Gates wouldn't listen to him. So what I'm saying here is that what is it now? Even Casey was better than this fellow we have called William Burns, who is just a cog in the wheel and who knows better, but keeps telling the president, you're doing just a fine job, Mr. President. And besides, the Russians have already lost. And he said that in early July of last year. So that's what you have now at head of the CIA. The head of that, Abel Haynes, is worse still. So you don't have any character that I know of. So it's up to us, folks. You know, my favorite theologian, Annie Dillard, used to always say, look, there is only us. There never has been any other. Let's recognize that, get out there, and make sure that us is heard by the powers that be.
Yeah, Gates said they were bluffing. I was going to end the program asking about December 7th, and now we're moving into the third hour of this discussion, and it reminds me of the early days of Conservative News when we did five-hour programs. I'm not asking you to stay 5 hours, but I am asking you to please, if I could ask one more question about Ukraine, and then I want to say a few words about what's going on in Israel, because I think it's being overshadowed, and it's incredibly dramatic in its own right, obviously. And my question to you, Ray, is I was speaking to an American journalist in Washington here the other day, and I said that I thought Biden was being incredibly reckless with all of this. And this journalist said, oh, I think it's brilliant what he's done. I said, brilliant? I mean, I was stunned. What's brilliant about it? Well, because Putin can't do anything, and he won't do anything, because he's waiting for Trump to come on. So he's bluffing. He won't do anything about it because he thinks Trump's going to happen. They boxed Putin in, and they're making him look humiliated. And that is the thing I suggested, that the humiliation factor in this whole story, starting for 30 years, the end of the Cold War, the end of the Soviet Union, when Wall Street moved in and took over the economy and actually stripped the country, impoverished the entire Russian people, and used, of course, Yeltsin as their puppet, and the oligarchy class rose up until Putin came and, as Scott referred previously, put an end to that and transformed Russia again and returned their sovereignty and their self-respect. But that humiliation continued when you look at the Munich Security Conference of 2007, Putin's speech, constantly pushing Russia back and not respecting them. And this humiliation factor until the 2014 coup, the egging on of the coup government to attack the Russian speakers who were defending a democratic outcome, all the way up until the very end when the treaties in December 2021 to the U.S. and NATO were rejected out of hand by the United States, again, spitting in the faces of the Russians. That this humiliation factor is what is not being taken into account at all right now. And then I saw you on the judge, Ray, you mentioned, you made a reference to Kennedy's American University speech. And could you please repeat that, what he said about humiliation?
Well, in his speech of June 10th, 1963, JFK, just a few months before they killed him, said that, you know, we ought to reach out to the Russians. They have children, and their aspirations for their children are the same as ours. We breathe the same air. We drink the same water. Let's see if we can't do something cooperative. I volunteer to stop nuclear testing over the ground right now. Well, he finished up by saying, look, in the final analysis, there's one thing that rings true. Here, 8 months after we almost destroyed the world, okay? That was the Cuban Missile Crisis in September, October 1962. So this is 63 June. And he says, the one thing we should always avoid as nuclear powers is to orchestrate events in such a way that we give the other nuclear power a choice between humiliating retreat and using nuclear weapons. Make sense? Yeah. So when Obama came into office, and I'll just finish with this, because there were some more sober heads than Blinken, than Biden. Biden was vice president, but Obama was president. And when they started talking about bringing Ukraine into NATO, and I concede that Obama let Victoria Nuland and the others do that coup in Kiev, okay? But then Obama said, look, we're not going to give any offensive missiles to Ukraine because that would give the Ukrainians the idea that they could prevail over a much stronger Russia. And at that same time, there was a deputy secretary of state who drew a broad line under that. Yes, Mr. President, you're absolutely right, because if we gave them offensive arms, the Russians could match it. They could double it. They could triple it. They could quadruple it. So wise decision. Do any of you remember who that deputy secretary of state was? His name was Antony Blinken, one of the best and the brightest. And so when Biden comes in, Antony Blinken forgets all about that, and they start making believe they can use Ukraine to weaken Russia, and that's where it all started. Now, is there a situation such as JFK warned about? I do not think that the Russians are going to be provoked into using nuclear weapons. They don't have to, and I don't think whatever these guys do, if they're crazy, they're crazy. I can't rule that out. But is there a chance that Blinken and Sullivan, who are ruling the roost now, would they be tempted? Would they be tempted to do a false flag that would justify the use of a mini nuke somewhere to kill Russian forces? My God, just to hear myself say that says that's crazy, McGovern. But they've done everything short of that, right? Everything they said they weren't going to do, tanks and F-16s and the whole rest of it. So these guys are a little bit crazy and they're a little bit dumb, okay, or a lot dumb. What would prevent them from avoiding humiliating defeat in Ukraine, which is going to come whether they like it or not, and instead, to avoid that in some way, they would fire a tactical nuke? Well, you have people at SAC like Admiral Buchanan who says we can do that, we can win a limited nuclear war. So all I'm saying here is that Kennedy foresaw that we could get into situations like that because he had existential experience with it over Cuba in September, October 1962. Just a little twit note here. I was called to active duty as an Army Infantry Intelligence Officer at Fort Benning on the 3rd of November, 1962. There were no weapons at Fort Benning at the Army Infantry Training Center in November of 1962. Short, like a naive second lieutenant, I asked the master sergeant, I said, Sergeant, you don't have any 155 millimeter, 105 millimeter? Yeah, where are the shells, the 155 millimeter? Well, actually, Lieutenant, he said, didn't you know that two infantry divisions came through here 2 weeks ago, took all our weapons? They're down on Key West now. They were ready to get into Cuba. I guess maybe they cooled off now, but they're still down there. That's why you have no weapons. So it's a personal experience how close we came. The JCS wanted, they were hellbound on invading Cuba, getting rid of that commie Castro. Luckily, you had JFK at the helm. You had connections. Jack Matlock was on the other end of that teletype, okay? It wasn't fancy then, a teletype where they were communicating. And as I said before, Llewellyn Thompson, arch specialist on the Soviet Union, was at every one of the crucial committee meetings that JFK ran during that time. So it's possible to avoid this stuff, but only if you're kind of perspicacious enough to make sure that you don't put the other side into a choice between humiliating retreat and using weapons. I think that the real reality here is that Putin is smart enough to work out a deal, not to be scooped, not to be provoked, And when Trump comes in, it will not be a humiliating defeat that Putin wants to inflict on him. He never wanted to take over the whole of Ukraine, much less Poland or the Baltics, for God's sake. There's the makings of a deal there. All the Russians want is to feel secure. If Trump says, all right, Ukraine will not be in NATO anytime soon. And if you contain or retain dominion over those four oblasts in Ukraine, we'll talk about Crimea later. Let's do a deal. Let's have a ceasefire. There's no reason in God's heaven where that couldn't happen. I look forward to that. Maybe Trump is not smart enough to do that. Maybe the people behind him are just as dumb as Blinken and Sullivan. But I have some hope that they'll be different and that they'll be more sensible. Sorry, that's a long answer to your question, Joe, but it has to do the humiliating retreat.
Yeah. I think you invented a new word, humiliterization.
Yeah.
So, what I do want to say is that we've discussed this article many times in the New York Times that pointed out why Obama did not give lethal aid to Ukraine. And he said, one, it's in Russia's interest, Ukraine, and it's not really in America's interest, and we don't want to rile them up. And two, we don't want American weapons falling into the hands of thugs. The word he used was thugs. He had to know about Azov and people like that. So Obama knew that there were neo-Nazis there, and he didn't want American weapons. One of the smart things, along with the Iranian nuclear deal and diplomatic relations with Cuba, but he let his people go on their own in Libya, and as you said, in the coup in 2014. What did I want to say? I want to move on to Israel, unless there's something you guys want to You guys want to say some more on Ukraine, the three of you, yes.
Obama also told his unofficial biographer, Jeffrey Goldberg.
Okay.
Yeah, in 2016, before he's on his way out. He says, you know, Jeffrey, we have certain core interests, and the Russians have core interests, and Ukraine happens to be a core interest of Russia, and it's not a core interest of ours. And so we have to be really careful of getting into wars or conflicts where our core interests are not involved, okay? Well,
how wise. How wise that sounds now.
Yeah. And with the help of Putin, mind you, in 2013, he was able to avoid unleashing another war against Syria on false pretenses. Because Putin said, look, I persuaded the Syrians to destroy all their chemical weapons under UN inspection. And Obama said, you did? Why didn't John Kerry tell me about this? Well, long story there. But that avoided a war with Syria. And the neocons were so angry at that. And I experienced that personally on the top of the CNN building. So angry at that that 6 months later, they did the coup in Kiev. And a hope for cooperation expressed by Putin in an op-ed in the New York Times on the 12th of September, 2013. He said, well, we've been able to cooperate now. I hope for trust, and not only trust between our countries. It looks like trust between myself and President Obama. The only thing I can't abide, says Putin in this last paragraph, is the notion that some countries are exceptional. President Obama said that just a couple of weeks ago. I think there are small countries, big countries, countries closer to democracy, countries farther from. But when the good Lord looks down at all these countries, he sees them as equal, period, end quote. That's the rub, folks. We're not exceptional, certainly not indispensable. The Russians believe that we still think we are. And that's the rub, and we're going to have to work through that. Hopefully, Trump will be more sensible, if you will, on that score.
Well, contrast that with Biden, who in the 1990s said, we know that by expanding NATO, we're going to rile up the Russians and upset them, and let's do it, basically. Let them ally with Iran, he joked about in the 1970s. This is the same man in charge now. Scott and Ted, before I ask a closing questions about what's going on in Israel, the indictment, the arrest warrants for Netanyahu. Can you add some concluding remarks on Ukraine and Russia?
No, I'm fine. I think we've covered the ground. So
okay.
Well, I'll just say this. Russia doesn't give a damn what Donald Trump thinks. Russia doesn't give a damn what Joe Biden thinks. Russia doesn't give a damn what anybody in the United States thinks. Russia is at war with Ukraine or a special military operation because there are things that were happening that were unacceptable to Russia, and this war will end on terms dictated by Russia that meets the operational objectives of Russia, and Russia will not yield on any of those, nor should they. They're winning across the board. So I think anybody who holds out hope that Donald Trump's going to come in and negotiate a deal, Russia will dictate the terms of this conflict, and if Donald Trump is willing to accept Russia's terms, then there will be peace. But Russia will not compromise on any of its core issues. Ukraine will never be a member of NATO. There will never be a solution to this problem that holds out the possibility of that. So the United States will have to yield on that point. Russia will never accept any peace until the West accepts the fact that Russia is sovereign over not only the four territories, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk, but Crimea as well. The West will have to accept this in treaty form and lift all sanctions. That is a non-negotiable. Unless Trump is ready to lift all sanctions and accept these, there will be no settlement. Ukraine will be demilitarized. The fact is the Ukrainian military will not be allowed to be above 50,000 strong, and that will be limited in terms of the weaponry available to it. That's a non-negotiable thing. There would be a demilitarized zone policed not by NATO but by Russia. That's non-negotiable. Denazification is non-negotiable. There will be constitutional changes in the Ukrainian constitution that outlaws these political parties. Non-negotiable. And anybody in the West that thinks that this isn't going to happen, just watch what the Russian army is doing on the front lines right now. They aren't losing. They're winning. They're not suffering massive casualties. They're inflicting massive casualties. The West is so out of touch with reality. And again, because we don't have Russian experts, we don't understand the Russian positions and how strong Russia holds to these positions. So I just think that one of the reasons why I said the 1 in 14 million chance is because Trump has no clue about what Russia's fighting for, why Russia's fighting for it, and why Russia will never compromise on this.
Well, Ray, you did say you didn't think that Russia would be provoked into using nuclear weapons. But which is maybe slightly different to what Scott is saying, what would happen if there was a barrage of attackums, of storm shadows, of the French missiles? Will they be able to withstand that until January 20th? After what he said, after the warnings that Putin has given?
Well, in that kind of scenario, we've already established that Putin has acknowledged he has a whole bunch of these new missiles, right? I think that he would retaliate in masse in key military facilities, including those inhabited by NATO allies in Ukraine. There's an outside chance he might hit an airfield in Poland or Romania, or even that missile base that has just been perfected and put there into Poland. I don't think that's likely unless we have the wrong range on these attackums. 190 miles. Look at the border there area there between Moscow and Ukraine. 190 miles is not much, particularly since the Russians have vacated some of their bases and their aircraft. The other thing is, how many attackums do they have? We don't know. We know they only have a small supply because that was used as justification by the defense secretary for not authorizing use of these things way back when, 2 months ago, okay? So there are a lot of uncertainties here, but I don't think that it's beyond the Russians to respond in a very, very very artful but non-nuclear way to whatever we throw at them in the next 7 weeks.
Very good. Ted, you raised Israel, so let me ask you this. I was in the UN headquarters for 25 years as a reporter. I remember when the very first talk about an international criminal court began by the French in the 90s based on the ad hoc courts that were created for Yugoslavia and Somalia, and eventually it came to be. And the U.S. actually signed the treaty. Clinton did. Bush unsigned it. It was never ratified, clearly. Palestine, when it became an observer state in 2012, went on a path to becoming a member of the ICC and a bunch of other UN related organizations, international organizations. Therefore, Palestine, as a member, as a legal state, an observer state, joined the court, and these attacks on Gaza have taken place on Palestinian territory. That's the jurisdiction that the court has used. Did you think we'd see this day? Because in frank discussions I had with NGOs and even some diplomats in those days, they never thought ever an American, a European, or an allied leader like Israel, like an Israeli prime minister, would ever be indicted by this court. This was for African dictators and, you know, for somebody like Milosevic, although that was the ad hoc court, and then ultimately for Putin, but never a Western white leader. So what does this mean for Israel that finally, have they gone so far that they got the ICC to indict Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, keep in mind that I'm a technical person, not a political expert. I don't have this deep understanding of history and social systems that other people who might be better suited to answer this question would be. But my view is that the United Nations has been completely intimidated and taken over by the United States, and it has done a very wide range of things that, at least that I've inadvertently become aware of, that could not possibly stand scrutiny. If you looked at, for example, the failure to report accurately to the General Assembly what really happened in the Damascus nerve attack in August of 2013. I mean, that was a blatant failure on the part of this guy Aka Selstrom, who was the director of the team. I mean, it bordered on criminal. And So when I see the UN finally acknowledge what Netanyahu has been doing, it is a surprise to me, because I don't have a sophisticated understanding of the internal politics there. But I do know that it's totally justified that Netanyahu is without doubt a human rights violator and a war criminal to match any that we have talked about or focused on in the 20th and 21st century. I mean, what's happening in Israel now is a genocide. And I don't, you know, people get upset when, you know, you use that word, and but, you know, there's no other way to describe it. And there's an ethnic cleansing going on, and in fact, a mini genocide, there's a threat of it in South Lebanon. And I, for one, can't understand how Israel is unable to stop this guy. The Israeli system is so rigid. He's got such a hold on the system that he's able to continue doing this. But we have the same problem in the United States. You know, we have a president here who supported this criminal Israeli activity and is himself involved in criminally undermining and threatening the security of our whole country with regard to the possibility of nuclear war with Russia. So, you know, you're, in some sense, you're asking the peasant.
Okay.
Because
let me ask a prince and Scott Ritter.
Okay.
Don't do that.
Last night, I'm leaving the king for last. That's right. But I'm saying, last night Netanyahu made a speech in which he attacked the Shin Bet with their FBI and I think the IDF over these documents. And his spokesman, who's been arrested, and some people, France 24 reporters, said this is a civil war beginning, without shooting, but by words right now in Israel. And then Scott's written for us and spoken elsewhere about the implosion of the Israeli state. But first, before you talk about that and the impact on this, is the indictment and the arrest warrants for Netanyahu part of this implosion of the state? And were you surprised by this? And is this a game changer? And the last question, is the U.S. going to try to shut down this court by starving it of funds with its allies?
I think the ICC is doomed. The United States is going to starve it. The Trump administration is inclined to do that. It's stacked its team with very pro-Israeli, some people call them Zionists, but definitely people who are inclined to give Israel full support. There is no sympathy lost inside the Trump administration for the ICC. So I don't see that court lasting. I think we are going to see the worst in America as we threaten to arrest people. We may actually arrest some of their judges. We will seek to do financial harm to them and their families. We will harass them. This is what we do. We're a horrible country. I'm sorry. I love my country, but we do horrible things. And this will be us at short of killing people, this will be us at our absolute worst, showing that we have no regard for law, etc. The International Court of Justice is more difficult for us to go after because it is, after all, an extension of the United Nations system. But we will do our best to again put pressure on judges. We have a history of calling judges up and threatening them. That's what we do. And I think we'll do that again. I don't believe that anything that's happening inside Israel is related to these two indictments. These indictments do not resonate within Israel, just like they don't resonate within the United States. I think what's happening to Netanyahu right now is very serious, extraordinarily serious. Seymour Hersh wrote an outstanding article. I don't know if you read his blog or his Substack, but he published an article there that lays out what's going on here. Netanyahu has accessed the crown jewels of the Israeli intelligence, this 12-page document from Hamas that was captured by the IDF that outlines Hamas's strategic objectives regarding October 7th. This document is closely held. It's not supposed to be referenced. They don't want Hamas to know that they have this document. And you're not allowed to copy this document. You're not allowed to take notes when you read this document. And you have to be invited in to see it. You have to show that you have a need to know. Netanyahu sent one of his representatives there who violated all these things. He wasn't supposed to be there because he doesn't have a need to know, but Netanyahu pulled strings, doors were opened, the guy went in, copied, took notes, and Netanyahu turned it into a briefing slide that he briefed to the Israeli public, and he lied. You see, he went in and he cherry-picked the information off of this document. He went in and said that this document proves that Hamas sabotaged any effort to get the hostages back, that Sinwar was going to flee to Egypt, bring the hostages with him, and then go on to Iran. And therefore, you can't blame me, Netanyahu, for a failure to get the hostages back because Hamas never intended to begin with, and this is what we've been saying all along, da-da-da-da-da. That alone should have him arrested because he wasn't supposed to reference the document. But he committed a second crime. He lied. Because the next two pages in that document show that what he was talking about was policy options presented to Sinwar, which Sinwar then proceeded to reject adamantly, saying, no, I will stay in Gaza. The hostages will stay in Gaza, and we will continue with our policy objective of using the hostages, exchanging them for a ceasefire. So Netanyahu lied. I don't think we in the West have an appreciation for how much trouble Netanyahu's in. This is so sensitive that the judge had to seal the file because if people start talking about this hostage thing, it could very well trigger a civil war. The Israeli people are so furious at Netanyahu for lying to them, for failing to get the hostages back, for getting them dragged into this conflict. Remember, the conflict with Hezbollah would not be happening if Netanyahu had done a hostage deal and brought about a ceasefire. And the Israelis are getting slaughtered in Lebanon right now. I mean, they're slaughtering Lebanese too, but I'm just saying that from an Israeli perspective, because they never care about Arab life, they are losing casualties like you wouldn't believe in Lebanon, and there's no hope of reversing that. The Israel was on the verge of a civil war prior to October 7th. The Israeli president warned that because of Netanyahu's attempt to rewrite Israeli basic law so that the courts could be politicized, taken over by the Likud party, and therefore he would be guaranteed never to be prosecuted for the crimes of corruption that he had been charged with, hundreds of thousands of people went into the streets and they were protesting against him. Many pilots who were reserve pilots in the Air Force said they refused to fly with him as the prime minister. And it was close. The president said, we are close to an actual shooting civil war, not civil disobedience, civil unrest, a civil war where Israelis shoot at Israelis. Today, it's even worse. This issue of the hostages, there has been a breach of trust. Benjamin Netanyahu is no longer trusted. His firing of Gallant has created huge problems within the military. Israel, what's the new defense minister's name? Israel something. He's not a trusted agent. The military doesn't have confidence in this guy. And the military is being sacrificed. There's increased suicides. Israeli soldiers are just killing themselves because they don't want to go back to Gaza. They don't want to go back to southern Lebanon. Desertion rates, depending on the unit, go from 12% to 24%. Israelis just refusing to show up. The active duty units are demoralized because in Gaza they're going back for the third and fourth time over the terrain and fighting over it again because they can't hold it. Hamas is there. You can't get rid of Hamas. They're going into northern Gaza where they're trying to, in wanton violation of international law, depopulate the area, but they will never depopulate Hamas. Hamas is underground and they have no solution for that. And Hamas will continue to kill them and they'll never occupy this. And the Israeli army knows this. The same thing in southern Lebanon. They keep trying to take villages. They haven't taken one village. The fact is, they just fought a battle in the village. We don't know what the casualties are, but they're going to be quite high because they lost a helicopter full of wounded people they're trying to bring back. They got trapped. The rumors are, and I believe these rumors because I hear from multiple sources, that an entire platoon was surrounded, ran out of ammunition, was going to be captured by Hezbollah. And the Israelis fired missiles at them to kill them in accordance with the Hannibal directive. So the Israeli military just killed a platoon of Israeli soldiers because they didn't want them to be captured by Hezbollah. That's how bad things are going right now in southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, Israel is just committing mass murder. The Palestinians is well documented. I don't think people are quite picking up on how bad it is for the Lebanese of southern Beirut. It's as bad as Gaza was at the beginning. They're being slaughtered. I have very good friends there. I'm in contact with them every day just because I'm scared to death that one day when I send them the telegram message, that little X that says sent doesn't turn into the 2X that says received, and then doesn't turn into the blue that says read. I'm concerned that I will send a message that will never be read by them because every morning there's a building going down with entire families being consumed. I know journalists who worked at Al-Mayadeen, and their building was hit. Marwan Osman, a wonderful lady journalist, she is fearing for her life there. They're targeting her. The Israelis are trying to kill her because she dares speak out against the horror of what they've inflicted on the Lebanese people. We Americans claim that we stand for certain things, but in when it comes to Israel, we stand for nothing. We are genocidal facilitators. We are the practitioners of mass murder. The bombs being dropped are American-made bombs, and we know what they're going to do with these bombs. We give it to them, and yet we continue to give it to them. We don't do anything to intercede. We lie, we cheat, we steal. And it comes down to, then to Israel. The world has lost faith with Israel. There was a time when the world was willing to turn a blind eye to some of the lesser crimes of Israel that the world was willing to do. Just right before October 7th of 2023, on September, I think, 9th or 19th, Joe Biden announced a new policy at the G20 summit in India. He said, we're going to implement what's known as the India-Middle East-European Economic Corridor, and that this would redefine the region and elevate Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu came on and gave a presentation where he said that this is the greatest day in modern Israeli history. This is the greatest event because it redefined Israel. It took Israel out of the doldrums where people were, concerned about, the West Bank and everything. But through the Abrams Accord passed by the Trump administration, Israel was being positioned to have normalized relations with Gulf Arab states. The last cog of this was Saudi Arabia. They were finalizing the negotiations with Saudi Arabia. And if they did this, then the India, Middle East, European Economic Corridor could become reality, and Israel would be elevated into economic relevance on a regional basis. And Netanyahu was like, this is the greatest thing in the world. That is dead. That will never happen. It's done. And along with it is the Israeli economy. $67 billion hit last year, $100 billion hit this year, will never recover. No tourism, no tourism, no tourism. Nobody's visiting Israel right now. The southern port of Eilat is shut down because of the Houthi naval blockade, not to open anytime soon because the Houthis certainly aren't being defeated. Haifa is being attacked. Insurance rates are up. Israel is a basket case. Economically, militarily, they can't win. Iran has shown that Israel can be taken off the face of the earth at any moment with 1,000 to 2,000 precision-guided missiles that Israel can't shoot down. Their Iron Dome, the David Sling, the Patriots, whatever, don't work. Israel is in desperate situation, and what's going to happen is eventually, in order to bring this thing to an end, the key is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia just told MBS, just met with Putin, I think last week, and he said that we will never normalize relations with Israel until there is a Palestinian state and its capital is in Jerusalem. Now, Netanyahu said that will never happen, but Netanyahu is not long for this world, I'm just saying. He will not be prime minister much longer, in my opinion. He cannot be prime minister because he's killing Israel and the Israelis know it. Why did he go after the Shin Bet? Because the Shin Bet knows what kind of criminal he is. Why did he just sanction Haaretz? Because Haaretz tells the truth about the criminal nature of this regime. Benjamin Netanyahu is going down. He will be out of office before Trump becomes president. That is a fact. But the problem comes when they try to dig their way out of this. Everybody's talking about a two-state solution. You can't have a two-state solution unless there's a second state, the potential of that. You can't have a second state unless you do something about the settlements in the West Bank, even if it's a compromise, even if they say we're not going to get rid of them all, but we get rid of some. The moment the Israelis move to take down the West Bank settlements, you will have a civil war in Israel, an actual shooting civil war where Jews are killing Jews. And that's it. That's the end of Israel. At that point in time, the demographic shift is hundreds of thousands, if not millions, flee. Israel will not be able to sustain itself demographically. And at some point in time, the numbers reach the point where you can no longer talk about sustaining a standalone Jewish state. And now we're at a one-state solution, and that's the end of Israel. That's what's going on here, and it's all because of Benjamin Netanyahu. Benjamin Netanyahu will go down in history as the man who killed Israel. I think you're muted.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Scott. I'm just going to move on to King Ray, since we have 5 minutes to the third hour, and I think it's a good time to stop. Any concluding remarks, Ray, on on Israel and on the indictment of Netanyahu and what Scott's been saying?
Well, I'm encouraged about the indictment. I agree with all that has been said about the fecklessness of the UN, but they did step up to this one finally. And of course, under the principle of universal jurisdiction, Netanyahu and Gallant are not able to fly around the world like they used to, let's put it that way. They are subject to arrest by any of the other signatories of the Rome Treaty. With respect to Scott's very bleak outlook for Israel, I agree completely with it. I only wonder what happens to the nukes. You know, in extremis, what would a fellow like Netanyahu do or try to do? And if he tried to do something really strange with the Israeli military, stop him. I don't know the answers to all that, but my God, those are scary questions as well. Iran, I think, has shown that it can hit Israel and can decimate Israel. And so what does that mean? Netanyahu wants to get us involved there, at least as soon as he can, maybe before Biden leaves. And is he going to start a war with Iran, knowing that he would either lose or come to a stalemate unless the U.S. comes in with both feet? I don't know the answer to these questions, but they're real scary. And I finish here by saying the notion that my country would be enabling, would be arming a country that is doing genocide, it's just so preposterous and so saddening and so anger-inducing that it's hard for me to talk about it. So the sooner Netanyahu goes and sooner there's more peaceful people come around and say, look, you know, we used to be above things like genocide, for God's sake. Let's knock that off. Well, as soon as that happens, it can't be too soon for me.
Can I just add one thing to give you hope, Ray? We call Israel an apartheid state because it is an apartheid state. But that's an important term because once upon a time, there was an apartheid state in South Africa, an apartheid state that hated blacks as much as Israel hates Palestinians. In fact, they hated blacks so much that they had a covert nuclear weapons program so that they could defeat black nationalist groups that were being assisted by communism, etc. 7 weapons were built. Others were being prepared for reserve. But when the South African regime collapsed from its own decay, the government realized that they couldn't turn over control of South Africa to the black nationalists if they had nuclear weapons, because they weren't going to give nuclear weapons to the black nationalists. So they called the International Atomic Energy Agency. Suddenly South Africa signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Weapons inspectors went in, destroyed the nuclear weapons, dismantled the nuclear program, and brought South Africa into compliance. If the collapse of Israel is managed correctly, because Israel has the Samson option, that is, if Israel feels as though nations are, if it faces an existential threat from the nations surrounding it, it will take all the nations down as it goes down. You know, the Soviet Union had a nuclear weapons program, too, that was designed to prevent the Soviet Union from being existentially defeated. But the Soviet Union collapsed from within. If Israel collapses from within on its own volition, I do believe that the Israeli government will execute the South African plan. Rather than allow their nuclear weapons program to be taken over by the Palestinians, Israel will contact the International Atomic Energy Agency. Israel will sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and Israel will voluntarily allow its nuclear weapons program to be dismantled before Israel goes away. That's my hope, and that's what I am working for.
Wow. Scott, I wrote down in my notes South Africa. I was about to just tell that very story, which I wrote for Bob Perry. 9 years ago, I wrote an article for Bob Perry when he was still with us, Consortium News. saying that there's no way that Israel, if it's going to become a one state, would let its nuclear weapons fall to the hands of Arabs, so they will get rid of them, just as South Africa did. So thank you for bringing that up. We are exactly at the three-hour mark, and I want to really sincerely thank everybody for being here so long and discussing, as Ted said, pretty thoroughly of these issues. And I hope to have you back again soon if we're still around in a couple of weeks. So I will see you in Washington in December. Around that time, Scott, I would like to certainly be involved in covering all of those things that you mentioned. So for Elizabeth Voss, my co-host, Kathy Bogan, our producer in Sydney, Australia, Ray McGovern, Scott Ritter, and Ted Postle, this is Joe Lawyer for CN Live saying goodbye and thanks for joining us.